Celtic Stuff Live, the only toll-free call-in webcast produced specifically for Celtics fans. With your hosts, Jughead, JB, and the Duke. Celtic Stuff Live. And now, Jughead, JB, and the Duke.
Welcome to another edition of Celtic Stuff Live in the postseason. We got a couple of great guests tonight. Elrod Enchilada from Real GM and Michael McCann from Sports Law Blog. Looking forward to that. Definitely looking forward to that. JB and John, how are you?
Oh, I'm great. A great sports day today in Boston. The Red Sox win, and W.C. Moss was traded to the Patriots. And Steve Nash had 23 assists and dumped the Lakers down 3-1. And old Pat Riley is gone from the playoffs, and he takes old Shaq and old Antoine 1-for-5 Walker with him. And we don't have to listen to Antoine again this summer.
Yeah, thank goodness.
Isn't it great? Isn't it great? God bless the Chicago Bulls. There's a couple great things in that. One, obviously, like you said, we don't have to hear Antoine anymore. We don't have to see Dwayne Wade get bailed out 150 times a game. We don't have to see Shaq, you know, whining about not getting calls when he's completely blowing over everyone else in his path. And the other thing is, you see a young team in the Chicago Bulls who two years ago were written off for dead in the start of the season and have come on to be one of the best teams in the league. Sure, they've done it by adding a couple quality, what I consider veterans, obviously Ben Wallace, but all of his Nocioni, but largely with a homegrown cast of characters, not unlike what we have, which I believe not unlike what we have here. So there's a lot of good things to take out of that, and I hope Celtics fans can take heart in that. But certainly you don't have to look any further than the Western Conference playoffs and look where the real men of the league are playing, because there's just some unbelievable series going on right there with Dallas and Golden State, just tremendous basketball. It's a lot of fun out there, although we all have our eyes on May 22nd, that's for sure.
Well, could you imagine if the two teams in the finals last year were bounced in the first round this year? Crazy. And, you know, hey, I'm looking forward to the Bulls going to the finals. I've got a feeling about it. Pistons are the only ones that could be in their way, and I think that's to their advantage because Big Ben Wallace has got a chip on his shoulder playing his old teammates.
A lot of it depends on how Wallace, Rashid, and Weber hold up. You know, they're kind of hurting and getting up in age. That should be a great series. If somebody's got to get by, I don't know how it breaks down. Somebody's got to get by Cleveland. They're playing pretty well. They've only had Washington to play, but they seem to have found their inside game with Ilgauskas. That's not going to be a pushover.
I hope not. I think Cleveland stands a very good chance. We were telling Ryan McNeil when we had him on last week. I really think that 2-3 series, the next round. You know, Cleveland, I don't think, you know, neither New Jersey or Toronto is really, you know, showing what they can do in this series. If they continue to play subpar basketball, whoever wins that next, you know, that Cleveland series, which obviously they will, they're going to be rested. They're going to come into that series in the Eastern Conference Finals, and they may be able to really have a little bit more left than Chicago or Detroit will. And if that's the case, you know LeBron's going to get the calls.
Right.
I don't think it's beyond reason to see Cleveland in the final.
Yeah, they're going to match up against Detroit. No, they won't, because Cleveland is number two. I think Cleveland would wind up with the Bulls, and the Nets would play Detroit in the next round.
Don't reseed.
Well, so, Cleveland is seeded number two. Detroit's number one. Toronto's number three.
Right, it's Toronto. Bracketed. Yeah, so Cleveland's in the easy bracket with Toronto and New Jersey. And, right. You know, we told Ryan, we warned him. You know, That was an insane game by Kidd the other night. Was it 16 points, 16 rebounds, and 19 assists? I mean, that is somebody's. Who was telling us that Kidd didn't have much left in the tank? I mean, I know it's Toronto, but I mean, that guy's got. He's a vet. He's got years left. He's saving it for the playoffs, and he's got two or three more good years in the playoffs, I think.
He had one of his most productive seasons in the last four this year. I'm not sure he was saving it. He played pretty well, and they finished with a strong run to get there. I think the key to their season was obviously Kristic went down, but then Jefferson went down. When Jefferson came back and was healthy, they became a good team again, even without an inside player. Kidd is amazing. You see what, talk about point guards, Nash with 23 assists tonight. I think he's proving who the real MVP is. They can give it to Dirk, but everybody should know Steve Nash is the ultimate valuable player in this league. He had 23 assists. I want to get the box score up here because there was just an amazing factoid on Phoenix's 41 made baskets. He had 23 assists. The team had 34 assists. So out of 41 made baskets, there were 34 assists.
Yeah,
that's great, great team basketball. And I don't think anybody beats them all the way. With now that Stoudemire, he had 21 rebounds today. I don't see how anybody beats that team.
You know, the series that's really not getting any pub that I really am enjoying watching a bit is the Utah-Houston series.
Yeah.
And I know what you're going to say. It's, you know, slow down. It's defense. But it's really entertaining. And you've got a couple interesting matchups in that series. You know, watching as Kirilenko is, I think he went 0-for-1 with 3 points in the last game. You know, as he's really, it's beyond me what's going on with him right now. Obviously, the draft, you know, all the boards are all over trying to trade for him at this point. But, you know, you've got Okor, and he's pulling Yao Ming from the basket, and you know, looking at Boozer, I mean, just having unbelievable games, and McGrady. It's a really nice series to watch and look at the different matchups as they play out, and a couple real tactician coaches out there too. That's one that I think will obviously go seven games, or at least I hope it will. And yeah, because all the talk is about the Dallas Golden State series, which I know I'll be watching at 10:30. I don't know about you all.
There's a great quote from Jerry Sloan. They were asking him, you know, Kirilenko was getting moody and had a little tear in his eye during an interview the other night, and somebody asked Sloan, "What's wrong with Kirilenko?" And he says, "How the hell do I know? I'm a basketball coach. I'm not a mood coach. We're here. This is a team game. We're playing basketball. Why the hell are you asking me about this crap? Why don't you ask me about the game?" I just love that. He's just such a no-nonsense guy. And he'll get everybody playing. He knows what it takes. And that's the kind of coach we need here, somebody that's a real coach. I mean, it's one thing to be babysitting these kids, which Doc probably has done a nice job of. But
and what about the quote Van Gundy had for Sloan? I mean, here he is facing him in the first round, and Van Gundy comes out with effusive praise and says that, you know, Sloan's a guy that's going to get every last bit of effort out of, you know, the maximum potential out of any player. I mean, you know, get any guy to play for him and play well. I mean, that's pretty impressive, you know, when they're facing each other in the first round, for a coach to lay out that kind of, you know, I don't know, accolades on his opposing coach.
That's right out of the Bill Belichick school of, you know, talk up your opponent. You know,
that only works in football, John. This is apples and oranges, right?
The greatest opponent Bill Belichick faces is his next opponent. You know, he talks about these guys as if they're, you know, right on their way to Canton, you know, and half of them won't have a job in a month. You know, that's the great thing. You know, you talk up these guys, and I the good coaches understand it. You talk them up, you know, give them bulletin board material. You know, you make them sound like they're the greatest things since sliced bread, and they come out and you you tear their heart out for them and show it to them.
Well, you know,
that's how you do it.
You know, speaking of coaches too, Rick Carlisle, fired by the Indiana Pacers this week. He's a guy I like. I know we've talked a lot about possible replacements, and last week we spent a lot of time talking about Doc Rivers getting an extension, not getting an extension, being a lame duck coach, drawing some comparisons to Sam Mitchell when we spoke with Ryan McNeil. And, a lot of people, all of a sudden, after seeing what happened with Sam Mitchell, they all want to wait a season with Doc Rivers and see if he'll, do that again. And I just don't know if I see two coaches consecutive years back-to-back pulling off that kind of success. But, I even said, and I've said all along, that, I'm fine with Doc for one more year. However, Carlisle is a coach that I would I would be willing to make a move on. I think he's a brilliant coach. He's a good in-game strategist. And, I know everybody has knocked on him for his slowed-down style of offense and also supposedly not being a player's coach. But, I just ask you to look at some of the players he's been forced to coach. Ron Artest being one of those players and Steven Jackson. I mean, we're not talking, the easiest players in the league to be coaching. So I don't know if that's a fair criticism of his career to this point. And as far as the slowdown offense, if you look at the point guard situation for most of his teams, I don't see how he had anybody. Just if you look at his personnel, he has to play that style a game to give his team a chance to win. So, he's been added to the list of coaches that might be available this offseason. However, I think Doc is coming back. Just a guy that I would take a long look at.
You mentioned that about the tempo, and there was a good quote from Larry Bird. I think it came out of the Indy Star this morning, where he was asked about that, and he said, we don't play one style. We coach all styles. We want a team that can run. We want a team that can play in the half court. We don't want a team that's known as playing one style. And, I think probably Carlisle can coach any style of play, as you say, depending on the personnel. But if you're going to be a playoff team, you have to be prepared to play in the half court as well as take your opportunities to run. There are very few teams like Phoenix or that will ever absolutely be built on that model, and it won't be the Celtics because we'll have Jefferson at least, as a post player. And those are the teams that generally, year in and year out, win in the playoffs. You've got to be able to run, yes, but you also need to have that half-court offense and that go-to player in the post.
Yeah, so true. And John, you and I talked about this a little bit the night that it was announced that he'd been fired, and I was telling you how I liked him, but you're not so hot on Rick Carlisle coming in.
No, I'm not, and it's nothing against him as a coach. I think for a lot of teams, he would be an excellent coach. He got a heck of a lot out of some really bad Detroit teams. Well, not really bad, but not very good Detroit teams. That certainly under Larry Brown, they were a lot better, but there was a change in personnel there, and there was a number of reasons why what Carlisle did ended up being very, very, very good for Larry Brown in Detroit. And I think, certainly the people that he was left with in Indiana were a challenge. But that said, Carlisle, I think, is the type of coach that is not a good fit for this team. He obviously, as you mentioned, he's a tactician. He is a slowdown guy. I mean, That's the fact that it's what he was in Detroit. It's what he was in Indiana. And while I think that he would do great things for adding wrinkles to this team and making them a more, what's the word I'm looking for? But they're certainly
better execution.
Yes. Their execution is, you hope, would be better. I think actually the opposite would be true. I mean, from what I've read, there's been a lot of instances where he would put in new plays in the middle of shootarounds and things where if you do that with a young team, the type of team that we have with a fairly simple system from what I read, there's no reason to think that the amount of mistakes and the amount of errors that we'd see these kids make would triple. And there's obviously there's something to be said for the idea that if you brought in somebody of Carlisle's caliber, he would make them be more precise and better with following through on those things. I don't see it. I think that he would actually probably hold them back. This team needs more personality right now, and they need motivation, and they need to be able to get to that point. When they get to where they're just short of being that winning team, that's when you need to bring a guy like Carlisle, someone who's a tactician, someone who can win at the end of games. And I don't think they're at that point yet. I think Doc is still the guy to get them almost to that point.
Well, I'm sure we'll get into a little bit more of the coaching stuff a little later in the show. Just as we're backing up to break here, I'd like to shout out a little bit. We've got two of the bloggers out in the pit, and Red from Red's Army recently hosted what's called the Carnival of the NBA, where they make up link to many of the various different blogs, and Red got congratulations all over the internet. His name was everywhere for the creative, wonderful job he did.
An awesome
job. Haven't seen that. You ought to get over there. And then we have Loy, loyalist from Loy's Place. And if you haven't been to his site lately, my goodness, it's like entering into a video game. You log into that site, you're engulfed in color and images, and as I'm clicking around, things are coming flying at me, three-dimensional things, and all of a sudden it turns into this big picture of Paul Pierce. I wish I had a little gun hooked up, I could shoot it down, but he's taken this whole blogging thing, the experience visually, to another level. You'll really enjoy going over there. Great job, both of you guys, making a name for yourselves and bringing the whole Celtics blog them up another level. Both of you, great job.
Yeah, absolutely. I really loved the Red's Army post. It was kind of like, what is it, the one with that Simon guy? I can't remember. American Idol. So,
yes.
Yeah, it was awesome. And Paula Abdul was inebriated, to say the least, as always. When we come back, we're going to have Michael McCann from the Sports Law Blog. Stay tuned.
Celtic Stuff Live is brought to you by Garber Family Dentistry in Salem, Mass. Garber Family Dentistry is a practice that treats both children and adults using modern equipment. That includes intraoral cameras so that you can see what they see, and digital radiography. That's 90% less radiation than conventional x-rays. They also use sedation for people who experience anxiety during dental procedures. That's Garber Family Dentistry. Give them a call, 978-744-8495.
About 1 million and a half. 1-1. 1-1. Go ahead. Thank you. 1-1 now. 1-1 now. Call. Sold. 1,000,001. Thank you. Bidder number 225.
Allen Auction Company. Specializing in distinctive properties and municipal auction services. Using innovative sales and marketing strategies, they ensure that the auction day experience is both positive and profitable. Visit their website, allenauction.com, or call 781-592-8100.
And we're back from the break with a little AC/DC. We're going to fade that out and bring on our guest. Joining us now is Michael McCann from the Sports Law Blog. Michael, thanks for coming on the show.
Hey, thanks for having me.
My pleasure, Mike. This is JB. How you doing?
Hey, JB. Good. How are you?
Well, great. Loved your article. What's it called? The Situationalist? That you put up there about the nuts and bolts of the ping pong balls?
Yeah, we talked about the situation of the NBA draft and looking at, you're right, we began with the nuts and bolts of how the lottery works and how the draft works, which for most readers is already known. But we just wanted to have it all together in one document. And then we moved on to an analysis of what happens when a player is drafted. The media will start covering the players. We'll go on True Hoop and other websites and get some information about the player as he begins his NBA career. But the point of the real point of the article was, when we look back at a player's career and we see whether or not a player did well or not, we tend to either praise the player or blame the player. And our point is that it isn't as much about blaming and praising, but what situation was the player drafted in. If you take one player and you put him in a different situation with a different coach, a different team, a different philosophy, different fan base, different location, we may have a very different result. And certainly there are some players who will overcome the situation regardless of where they are. LeBron James, Tim Duncan. But a lot of players, I think, are deeply affected by where they work. Just like where we work, we're deeply affected by who we work with, who we work for. It has a real effect on our performance.
Well, you know, I you haven't been to our site, I guess, but I did a promo. If you get over to CelticStuffLive.com, you might want to take a look at before Jughead wipes it out after the show. I did a promo, and I quoted actually that part of your article, because while I thought that the nuts and bolts of the lottery was very interesting and needed to be, you know, simplified the way you did it, I did also thought that the real meat and potatoes of the article was that analysis, and I'll quote from it. However, when we evaluate these players, we usually focus on presumed but often immeasurable and perhaps misunderstood qualities like, quote-unquote, how hard they work or whether they have the, quote-unquote, drive to succeed, whatever that actually means. Now, that is very provocative, this so-called drive to succeed, because you're right, that is exactly what most coaches, GMs, will say about players that fail in their system, in their city, with their teammates, or whatever. And, you know, not only have we just had Sebastian Telfair strike out here and have his nameplate pulled from his locker, but the Patriots made some big news today by trading for Randy Moss. And would you like to comment on any of those situations in relation to your article?
Sure. One is that social psychologists have found that we're all very prone to looking at other people and assuming that they're making choices, and that however well they do or however poorly they do reflects their disposition. So how hard they work, something internal, something about them rather than the situation in which they're in. Whereas we're very good at seeing our situation. So when we have a job and we don't think our coworkers are good or we don't like our pay and other factors, we're really able to see it because we can see our own situation, but we're bad at seeing the situation of others. So I think what happens with players, you know, Larry Bird drive, right? I mean, there's the classic book right there on this presumed internal determination that he had that made him a great player. And he may have had that. It's not to say he didn't. But I think it's often used to criticize other players for not doing well, that they lack something inside. When, in fact, he could have just as well, in fact, more likely been who they were playing with, or the coach. I mean, look at Marcus Banks and Doc Rivers. Yeah, that was not a marriage that was made to work. Now, that's not to say Marcus Banks would have done well had he gone to a different team, and I was certainly a big critic of him over the years, but I think it's interesting when you put a player with a certain coach how deeply that affects the player, and yet we'll look at the player and say, what's wrong with you? In terms of Randy Moss and the Sebastian Telfair issue, I think Randy Moss is a classic case of a player who's clearly made some bad decisions, but has also been put in situations where he's more likely to fail. Playing on really bad teams year after year is not a good recipe for success, particularly when you're a star player. As to Telfair, I think he clearly made a mistake, and it's hard to completely defend him, but at the same time, as his lawyer noted, he was the victim of a robbery last fall. He has never been arrested until now. And I think as Scott Souza in the Metro West wrote today in a really good piece, you know, look at how the Celtics treated Sebastian Telfair versus how they treated Tony Allen. Tony Allen was alleged to have committed aggravated battery, telling another person in his group to F him up in reference to Mark Twain Johnson, whereas Sebastian Telfair had a gun. One is very violent, the other is possessing something, and yet Allen's contract gets extended, Sebastian Telfair's locker plate removed. It's a striking consequence.
Well, let me just pipe in a little bit on that, because, and this is Justin, but one of the things, the way I look at it, is that Sebastian Telfair had three incidences in 15 months versus Tony Allen. You know, I think you can compare the incident you know, with Fabulous and P. Diddy's, you know, New York nightclub, with what happened with Tony Allen, in that, you know, there's really no witnesses, there isn't a lot of evidence. While you probably believe down, you know, deep down in your soul that there's more than just a small element of truth in both incidences, from a legal standpoint, you know, it's kind of one that, you know, you can't get up as an organization. It's difficult to get up on your high horse when really there's going to be no legal ramifications. But in Sebastian's incident and Sebastian's case, I see two other gun possession charges during those 15 months. And, you know, the third strike being after a time when, you know, you would really think that maybe he would have done more to protect himself from, you know, getting into, the similar circumstance again.
Yeah, Allen did have an incident in college at a Whataburger restaurant where he was involved in some type of... Now, it wasn't an arrest from what I could tell. It appeared that he was apprehended and the school didn't really do much about it, but he had some kind of fight at a Whataburger, a riot while in college. But you're right, Telfair has had a pattern of errors. Although I think the robbery issue, he was robbed last year, and, you know, it's hard to blame someone for being robbed.
Of the F him up that came with Tony Allen's, you know, supposedly, yeah, Sebastian Telfair placed a call, and then, you know, a couple hours later, Fabulous has been shot, and, you know, yeah, you know, there's a supposed link there, but, you know, neither one of them can be proven to say, I said, shoot that guy or kill that guy or whatever, you know what I mean?
Right.
As far as that kind of ambiguity, that's all.
It's interesting that, not to get off topic, but the Chicago Police Department apparently leaked to the media that they had a videotape of what Allen did. It doesn't appear that the tape either existed or, in fact, did what they claimed it did, at least as they intimated to the media. But back to Telfair, you know, I mean, not to paint an overly sympathetic portrait of this guy, but he is somebody who grew up in a very difficult situation, who has not apparently abandoned those who he grew up with, which I think is admirable. I think a lot of players would make it to the NBA and then sort of ditch the past. Now, we can fault him for remaining in touch with people who maybe are bad influences on him, on those around him. But I think he's in a difficult situation. I think he's somebody who, from what I gather reading about him, I don't know the guy, but from what I gather, he does look out for those who helped him along the way.
And that is admirable. Yeah, you know, I agree with you, Michael. That is admirable. But here's my other thought on that. Why not hire a bodyguard? Why not just legitimize the possession of a gun and the protection of oneself in that circumstance? I mean, there's got to be other guys around the NBA that have figured out how to do that without, you know...
He had one with him, but unfortunately he was a convicted felon.
Yeah, a bodyguard... I think that's the lesson that, you know, a bodyguard is the way to go.
Right. Yeah, no, sorry, I didn't mean to. Hold on. I didn't mean to take you to task on that. I only just getting to the point a little bit quicker about, you know, that a bodyguard might be the better way to go. He's 21. You know, I get that he's going to make mistakes, and his career is certainly not over in the league by a long shot. Although it was interesting to hear what you said about Tony Allen in college having that incident. However, that wasn't with the Celtics. Do you think the Celtics are making a mistake, or one that it, I mean, I know a lot of the fans are saying, oh, this is a real contradictory position for them to be taking. And, you know, here they are, you know, they're doing one thing with Tony Allen, like you said, and another thing with Sebastian Telfair. Is that really going to hurt, you know, is that going to hurt the organization when they're trying to pull in free agents and stuff like that?
Yeah, it could. That's a really good point, because Telfair, you know, has made a mistake, but he hasn't been convicted of anything. And the team is really presuming his guilt in a way that was so sudden. I mean, talk about it. Well, one could say with a hasty response to immediately pull his nameplate. And I honestly wonder, if Sebastian Telfair had averaged 12 points a game and 6 assists, would the reaction have been so strong by the Celtics? This is a player, obviously, who was a major disappointment in the trade. He will consistently be compared to Brendan Roy, at least from Celtics fans' perspective. Now, I'm not even sure we would have been able to draft Roy, depending upon how the draft had actually worked out, but he was a major disappointment. And I imagine to Wick Grosbeck, to Danny Ainge, he was a major disappointment as well. And look, if Al Jefferson had done the same thing, would the reaction have been so swift, so vehement? I don't know. I mean, to me, I think the identity of who it was, being Telfair, a very disappointing player who the Celtics gave up a lot to get. And they did get salary cap relief, but I think people are just going to look at it as sort of a Telfair versus Roy perspective. And in that respect, Telfair was a major bust. So I don't, you know, will free agents be concerned by this? Yeah. I think free agents are gonna be troubled by how quickly the Celtics dumped Telfair just on the onset of an arrest. You know, a lot of people have been arrested for things that they were not guilty of. And it's not to say that Telfair wasn't guilty here, or at the very least he didn't do something stupid, even if he didn't commit a crime. But to just so quickly remove his nameplate, that's a very strong reaction. And I think a player, when looking at teams, may say, you know, this is an organization that probably purposefully lost games going towards the end of the season. Well, one could say it was dishonest to do that. Whether as fans we like it or not, you can set that aside. But so they're purposely losing games, and now they're talking about integrity when it comes to players. When a player who just happens to get arrested the next day, his nameplate is removed. I just think that's a...
You think there might be some sort of a premeditated intention? Is that what you're thinking? That they were waiting for an opportunity?
It wouldn't surprise... He had a really bad year. Now, it's hard to assess that without knowing what another player... how they would have treated another player in the same situation. We're never going to know that because another player is not going to do the exact same thing. But I would suspect that they were pretty upset with Telfair as a player, and that colored their perspective of him making a mistake.
Okay. We have an email question from one of our listeners that ties into the subject, and he wants to know what the NBA's policy towards players with driving violations and or gun possession is. Do you happen to know off the top of your head? I know we didn't shoot you that question ahead of time, but...
I don't believe they have a set policy. I think the NFL, with its recent code of conduct, and I may be mistaken, but I think the NFL is the only league that has a very specific policy on how to treat players. So my understanding is that the NBA takes it on a case-by-case basis and assigns sanction based on that, that there's no predictive method other than perhaps precedent in how they treated other players in similar situations.
Michael, I just happened to go over to the Sports Law blog and was very pleased to see that you put up a little promo for your appearance on the show tonight and went through four topics up for discussion. It's a great promo. Thank you. And I'd like to jump to one of them. And we're talking about Tony Allen. You mentioned the videotape. Danny Ainge was quoted in today's paper saying he didn't personally look at the tape, but somebody told him that there was nothing incriminating on there. I always felt that this would go away because the witnesses had no reason at all to want to see Tony go to jail or lose his contract, because the real benefit for them here is the civil case. And if Tony Allen is not playing basketball, they're not going to recover much or any money. Would you comment on that? And do you have any information as to whether anybody testified at this trial and or what was said? I guess it was a closed hearing. Is that what happened?
Yeah, my understanding it was a closed hearing. And I'm unaware of people testifying. I haven't read anything about that. It'd be interesting to know if that did occur. My impression is that it was a very quick trial, and it wouldn't surprise me if the prosecution had already decided to de facto drop the charges but allow an acquittal to go forward in helping Allen in his civil trial. But going to your point about whose interest was it to see Tony Allen go to jail, I think you're right. I think if you're bringing a civil suit, one would hope that the person you're suing has the resources to pay you. And Tony Allen having a fruitful NBA career, if you're one who's going to sue Tony Allen, is a positive, because you'll likely be able to extract more money. And I don't think the civil claim will even go to court. What I imagine is that Allen will settle out of court with Mark Twain Johnson and anyone else who brings a claim, that he'll basically buy off the claim now, because he's going to want to get this off his plate. And I imagine his advisors are telling him, look, you got to focus on rehabbing the knee, get rid of the legal issues, pay the guy off. Your contract has been extended. You're not going to be going to jail. Let's just put this behind us.
Yeah, I think that's right on. Exactly correct. I agree.
Yeah. Because who wants to deal with this with the season coming forward?
Yep.
Yeah. Michael, this is the silent partner of the three. This is the 2K.
Hey.
I wanted to switch gears for a little bit and talk about a little bit about Kendrick Perkins. This past week, it's been a busy week for you talking about the Celtics here. This past week, obviously, as you know, he was sued by his former high school assistant coach for, let's call services rendered, which I guess runs the gamut of just about everything. I don't know if he was a bodyguard and carried a gun at all, but I know that he was supposed to have done several things, and basically was a personal services agreement, is what it seems. It seems as though these types of contracts are pretty, or I'll use contract loosely, are pretty difficult for someone to prove and to go back into a court of law and say, you know, I deserve X number of dollars. And whereas Perkins has, you know, signed his new contract here last fall, I've got to believe that it look, at least from the outside, it looks like a money grab.
Yeah, and I mean, one, it's a really interesting fact pattern. One is that if I'm the IRS, I'm wondering whether the previous payments were made under the table. It sounds like this guy was living with Perkins for 3 years with no formal agreement and was receiving payments from Perkins. Now, maybe he was reporting it on his tax records. If I had a hunch, I would be a little bit skeptical whether he was reporting it. So one is that by bringing this claim, the gentleman, I believe his name is Michael Rylas, the former high school assistant coach who became the confidant, de facto chief of staff for Perkins, is exposing himself to some liability. Now, I may be completely wrong. Maybe he reported it and everything. But to me, it's a very murky relationship when a player, at least based on the media records that we have, a player and some other person are living together for an extended period of time and one is being paid. So there's that issue. The second issue is, when was the contract, the written contract, consummated in relation to the Celtics extension? It does appear that they were very similar in timing. But you know, we don't know what this guy was doing. Maybe he was very helpful to Perkins. Maybe he was performing some type of multi-tier service, be it his advisor, his guru, his trainer, sort of his close friend. Maybe he was keeping Perkins, being a good nexus between Perkins and those back home. It's hard to know. It does seem as if he was performing some services, but it is an odd fact pattern.
Yeah, it is interesting, and I'm just reading it and listening to you. I was not aware of some of these details. You know, for tax purposes, there are certain non-taxable fringe benefits that you can receive for living on a job site that was put into the Internal Revenue Code for logging camps and has been extended to people that live upstairs from funeral homes and people that manage apartment houses are given a free apartment, etc. But there's always, you know, other compensation that is taxable, and it almost seems here as if you may be right, and then the minute Perkins signed his big contract, Perkins' agent or his you know, above board advisors looked at the relationship and said, "Hey, you know, we got to get something on paper here. This could go badly." I think you nailed this one too.
Well, I appreciate that. I think you're right. I think this was something that was really driven by the Celtics' decision to give him the contract extension and the need to memorialize whatever agreement they had. And, you know, the fact that he's bringing this claim maybe suggests that he did follow all the rules and that he has an attorney who probably checked this, who said, you know, before you bring this claim, you want to make sure that you reported all the income, that it's consistent with the tax code. But it's a real strange case, and I think, you know, if we're in Perkins' position and we're leaving Texas at age 18 and going to Boston, maybe it makes sense to have somebody go with you. I think the premise of that is fine, but whenever the relationship becomes sort of a friendship slash business relationship, it always presents awkward issues, particularly if the player ends up making a lot of money, as Perkins has done.
Well, very interesting. I don't think anybody really realized the depth of that issue until you brought it up. And a lot of these kids bring somebody with them, especially high school kids. You know, some of them bring their mothers into
Marcus
town.
Marcus Banks, I think, brought his mother.
And you know, they do need somebody. And an old high school coach, you know, it seems like the perfect, shall we say, chaperone to keep him out of the bowling alleys late at night.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think the premise is great. Have somebody watch over you. And we mentioned Telfair earlier. If Telfair had sort of a big brother there, who knows whether he would be in the trouble he's in. So
yeah.
I think the premise is fine. Just how the person's compensated, I think, is the tricky part.
Yeah, you know, I just wanted to pipe in a little bit. Is how many you must be familiar with some of the agents around the league anyway. And I guess I'm just wondering, you know, aren't a lot of the, you know, the agents, companies, et cetera, providing such a collective or all-encompassing service to their players that they actually do a lot of this stuff for their players as part of the perks to getting them to sign on with their agency? Is that true, or do you know kind of, you know, if there's any validity to that? Because I've just heard a whole gamut of you know, responsibilities that, you know, sports agents and their agencies are taking on now.
Yeah, your instinct is correct. I was just on a panel with Maverick Carter, who is LeBron James's representative, and he intimated exactly what you just said, that the role of the agent now is to provide many services for the player, particularly if the player is a marquee guy. You know, would Kevin Pinkney need many services? No. But I would think a lot of guys in the NBA would need a lot of help. Now, there's always the tricky matter of whether an agent takes on too many responsibilities. If the agent is acting as an expert in tax, he better know tax law, because, as we just talked about earlier, it's a confusing area of the law, and some agents may not be well-versed in it, and they may be afraid to outsource the work because they're going to have to outsource some of their payment. So I think the more an agent does, the more vulnerable an agent becomes to a malpractice claim, because he's going to be opining on something that he may not be an expert in. So it's a tricky matter, because if you're an agent, you know, you don't want to give up the commission, but on the other hand, you don't want to act like a tax expert when you may have taken a tax law class, or you may not have.
Well, one thing I'm pretty sure of, Michael, is that Kevin Pinkney may want to invest at least in a taxi cab on his night home at the club.
Yeah, you would have been helpful. At least when he's in Reno.
That's true. Yeah, it is the biggest little city in the world. So, you know, I guess
right.
I guess you don't have to worry about some of those things. But I wanted to go to a post that you made back in, I guess it was a couple weeks ago now, on the Ryan Gomes brouhaha that had really stoked up there at the end of the season. And, you know, we didn't really talk a lot about that here. I think that largely we were probably, as much as anybody, probably tired of the tanking talk. But
yeah.
I wonder, you know, I've read some things today, both in the Herald and in the Globe and elsewhere, that David Stern is seriously looking at making some changes to the lottery and how it's done, how it's conducted. Due to some of the claims about teams tanking. And, you know, I just wonder what, you know, I know you've done a lot of work looking at players and as you mentioned earlier, the positions they're drafted into. But I wondered if you could maybe talk a little bit about the piece about, play, you know, teams openly tanking. And, you know, is this, I mean, to me it seems as though the light is shown on this phenomenon much more carefully when you have a guy of Oden or Durant's caliber than you do in years when Dwight Howard is there. You know, players are, you know, teams are still trying to jockey for position, but, you know, the scrutiny isn't there. How do you feel about that?
Yeah, I think this was a really interesting year because the tanking seemed as obvious, at least as obvious as it was when there was the Tim Duncan hunt about 10 years ago, when I think it seemed obvious as well. I remember the Celtics playing that season and some of the rather atrocious lineups they put out there, what seemed like an attempt to lose games. And, of course, ML Carr would later on. Now, I don't know whether we should take it at face value, but I think in 2001 he acknowledged that the team had a plan. It was part of the plan to lose games. So it appeared that Celtics were, in fact, tanking at that time. And this year, yeah, I think this is a year where you have two players in Oden and Durant who could change the course of a franchise for the next decade. And the difference between one of those two players versus whoever is the third guy seems to be enormous. Now, maybe in time we'll realize that the third and fourth guy selected will be just as good, if not better. We don't know. No one knew that Dwayne Wade was going to be as good as he was when he was picked fifth. So, but at least going into the draft, I think the incentive is there. If you're a bad team, to do everything you can to get that player, and to do it, however, in a way that's as least obvious as possible. But look, if you were to poll most Celtics fans, were they rooting for the Celtics to have the second worst record? I think most would say yes, and I would say yes myself. I wanted them to lose. I mean, I hated to see the team lose, but on the other hand, I really want us to get either Oden or Durant. But if we see other teams doing it, then it was annoying. I remember the Bucks had the sudden rash of injuries going in to play the Celtics. That was a little bit suspicious, but of course what we were doing was suspicious as well. But I think this was a season where we have enormously attractive players where there's no substitute when you have a franchise player coming up. We're also in a league where a superstar can radically change the course of a franchise. I don't think that's as apparent in the NFL. I don't think that's as apparent in baseball, where you have more players involved in the game. Moreover, I think there is the notion of people really aren't following the teams. We were watching the Celtics and following them. When you have an 81-game schedule and there's a lousy team on the other side of the country, who knows what they're doing? Unlike in the NFL, where every game really seems to matter and attracts a lot of attention, I think it would be harder to tank in that league.
It's an interesting topic comparison that you're making with football, because they only have 16 games. And you're right, there are teams out west that I don't follow, and I couldn't possibly even begin to claim that I knew any of the ins and outs. And, you know, to that vein, Eric Weiss just shot me a private message just talking about the fact that Ryan Gomes was taken out of context, kind of a cut-and-paste job into the article. And once David Stern got involved into the whole situation, four reporters volunteered to play Stern the unedited audio to protect Ryan. And I can tell you from having been in the locker room, he's a guy you want to protect, because he's very forthcoming and easy to talk to. And so, you know, you don't want to shut that avenue down from one of the, you know, the most enjoyable players on the team to talk to and insightful. So, you know, it's good to hear that, you know, Eric's comments, you know, in that vein. I wanted to move a little bit over towards, you know, the upcoming draft and talk a little bit about Oden and, you know, Mike Conley Jr. and Sr., both going with Mike's dad, apparently, to, you know, to talk about, you know, having him represent them. Is that unprecedented? And, you know, what kind of maybe complications or benefits can arise from going with somebody? I know that he does have a lot of contacts in sports, professional sports in general. So it's not like, you know, he's just coming in naive, and he himself was, I think he was an Olympic track athlete. So, and he represented himself back in his track days. So obviously he has some experience. But, yeah, maybe talk a little bit about that and just tell us, you know, some of the positives and some of the negatives with such a big name like Greg Oden going with Mike Conley's dad.
I think the biggest benefit for Oden would be familiarity. This is somebody who he's probably developed a friendship with, a trust with, a bond with, if you will, that separates him from other agents who were recruiting Oden, at least subtly recruiting Oden. So I think for Oden and his family, going with someone who he could trust was very important, I'm guessing, even though the agent that he selected doesn't appear to have the same experience level, expertise. I also think it's interesting because in the NBA, the agent really is limited in what he does. Oden will get selected probably first overall. He'll have the rookie salary cap to sign a contract to. You know, you or I could do it, to be frank. It's not really that difficult because the contracts are predetermined with the rookie cap. So I suspect Oden may have said, you know, the contract itself isn't really going to be that difficult to negotiate. It's not as if I need Scott Boras to negotiate, you know, my contract as a free agent in baseball. In the NBA, it's really not that difficult. Now, there's always the issue of access to endorsements, something that I know Maverick Carter, LeBron James' agent, talked at length about in terms of having an agent being in there who really knows how to market a player. And I think that's where Oden is taking a little bit of a risk. Because, sure, his NBA contract will be pretty basic, and anyone could probably execute it. But which endorsements to take? Does Mike Conley's dad have access to the best advertisers? Does he have the know-how to know which ones to select? Because if a player does a bad advertisement or endorses a product that he shouldn't be endorsing, that can have real ramifications on the player's economic future and certainly his reputation in the league. So I think there is risk. And I think there's always a sense that there was undue influence when the dad of a teammate becomes the agent, that he had access, that he had cultivated a relationship with Oden in a way that advantaged him in trying to recruit the player. But I imagine if any of us were in that position, we would have tried to do the same. It's tough to pass that up. But so there are conflicting ideas here, I think. I think the benefit is familiarity, trust. The drawback is undue influence, and another drawback maybe lack of know-how and insight on doing endorsement deals.
Yeah, it seems a little bit odd. On the other hand, it's even more odd, perhaps, that he'll be negotiating for his own son if his son signs. And I'm not sure that his son is going to sign before the draft. I don't think anybody knows that yet. But anyway, I think we're going to wrap up. Mike, it's been a great pleasure to have you, and you've opened up a lot of great topics for us. Is there anything that you're working on that you'd like to share with us? Anything you have going forward that you'd like some attention brought to?
Well, I appreciate that. There's nothing specific right now. I just try to blog on whatever comes up. I have some law review articles that probably aren't as interesting that I could talk about, but I don't want to put your readers to sleep. So... No, I appreciate that. If people could just go on Sports Law Blog and The Situationist, that would be great. And I appreciate you having me on.
Yeah, it's a great site. I've been looking at it a little bit. And like me, you like to use some really oddball photos, some old antique black and white stuff. There's some pit bulls fighting there. You went through the Michael Vick disaster and... You know, it's a very attractive site as well, obviously, is full of all your insights and knowledge on these topics. Good job, and thanks for coming on with us.
I appreciate it. Look forward to being on again.
Yeah, we look forward to having you on again, Michael. Very insightful, and, you know, that's Michael McCann from Sports Law Blog. Make sure to check it out. You know, John, I think something came up that... tweak that ruffled your feathers, huh?
I think so. Yeah, well, it was the comment that I guess a little tidbit of knowledge that you shared with us from Eric on the deal with Ryan. And first of all, let me just say, I like Ryan Gomes, and you know, while I'm not hesitant to trade him this summer, you know, I think he could be a valuable piece here. What he said wasn't the greatest thing, or how he was quoted was not the greatest. But I have a bit of a problem with the Boston press and in general saying, well, let's make sure that we protect this guy. I think that was the comment. The four writers said, well, David Stern, we'll give you our tapes. You can listen to how the interview went. And I understand that. But I don't know. It seems as though they're protecting the guy who gives them the good quotes. And you know, that's more of a sports media angle than probably a Celtics angle per se. And as a Celtics angle, I appreciate that anyone's trying to look out for our guys. It kind of calls into question their credibility and maybe their objectivity when it comes to you know, with the Celtics. You know, I like to see, you know, I think Ryan Gomes generally does the right thing, and I'm probably in this case he was misquoted. But but there's certainly an air of, this is a guy who we can always go to and get the quotes and fills our worthless game stories, and that's that. So, you know, it's just, it kind of rubs me the wrong way. So, you know, it's not really a Celtics thing maybe, but I think maybe there's some larger questions that people could draw from it and say, you know, are these guys, you know, really being objective, or are they, you know, just looking to protect the people who fill, you know, make their jobs easier? That's a scary prospect, Celtics fans, and you know, who knows if we're getting the true story. Something to think about.
Well, you know, with that, we're going to opening up the phone lines. We have about 20 minutes until we're going to bring on Elrod Enchilada from Real GM. We talked a little bit about his article last week, and we're going to expound on that this week with Elrod. But if you have some comments about, you know, what's got John... I should have played the music for you again, John. You know, like, anytime you get a chance to rant, you've earned the music. But anyway, the phone number for those of you in the pit, 1-866-751-9649. Give us a call. We might have a short time to catch some calls after Elrod comes on, but we've got a loaded show with two very knowledgeable and entertaining guests. So if you want to call into the show, be sure to do that now and take the time. John, I'm not so sure that I think it's that much of a big deal. I don't see it like they're necessarily protecting Ryan Gomes as far as with the relationship in mind so much as just making sure that he gets a fair shot, because, you know, if they do take those quotes out of context, they almost have a moral obligation to, you know, to present the full truth and nothing but the truth, don't you think?
Well, but then they should be putting that in their game stories or in their articles. You know,
but we know that they don't do that. I mean, they just...
Well, it's, but then, that's a larger problem,
well,
isn't it?
That is, but that's not Ryan Gomes' problem. I mean, I'm more...
I'm not pointing the finger at Ryan Gomes.
Right.
I'm pointing the finger at the media. I'm not saying Ryan Gomes is at fault for anything here other than what, you know, he said something and someone else took it the wrong way.
Right. No, you're right. I'm sorry. I didn't mean to...
cover the team.
Yeah, I didn't mean to put words in your mouth. Yeah.
Right. The people that cover the team are the ones that I have... you know, a question with, and you know, if they're doing it to protect Ryan, that's not their role. Their role is to cover the team and to be fair and objective, and you know, if that's the case, then you run the quotes the next day, and it was certainly a big enough media story. True Hope, you know, at ESPN, everybody was all over that story.
You're right about, you know, I tend to agree with your theory that, or your suggestion, recommendation to, you know, to play the not play, but to run the quotes in the next day's paper to kind of say, you know, this was the true context, just so everybody knows. But, you know, it's you save a lot more face by calling up David Stern and saying, oh, hey, you know, check out, we've got the full audio. It doesn't, you know, it didn't really fit into the story that we were going to write, but, you know, you're certainly right. Welcome to have it so that you realize, you know, that, you know, so that you have the full context. I mean, I guess that's why, you know, I've always kind of felt like, you know, when I was getting some of my interviews, that it was almost better to write an article and then have the full context interview as something you could listen to. I mean, people want you to sift through the information, but, you know, you make a really good point, and something that, you know, the new internet medium and the blogosphere in general has an opportunity, you know, has an opportunity to kind of advance the medium this way, which is to say that, you know, you write your story and you put your spin on it, but you put the full context interviews on the site as well. I mean, the diehards would appreciate that because they'd want to hear the stuff that maybe the general fans don't want to hear. And, you know, that was kind of what I envisioned when we were working with Celtics Blog this season, and Eric Weiss did a great job with a post that was posted up on Celtics Blog last night, just kind of talking to, I think, seven different players about their off-season plans and et cetera. So, you know, kudos to Eric for putting that together and to getting those interviews, because, you know, and again, a lot of the diehards are the only ones that want to listen to 4 or 5 minutes of audio. And that's, you know, I'd basically been posting that, but Eric kind of did what I had in mind all along, which is to say he pulled out the themes, the topics, and the major points that were made in those interviews, brought them out in an article, and then if you really wanted to listen to the full interview, you had it there available to you. And I have to tell you, I really think that that's where this is all going, and
exactly,
you know, it's really important to do that. So, you know, I agree with you in that aspect, John, 100%.
And that's the failing of the system that we have, is that more people get their news from, you know, a snippet, you know, 5, 6, 7 paragraphs, and that's the whole ball of wax. It only takes one quote to spin, you know, to spin the whole thing in, you know, off its top. That's the sad thing. That's what bothers me, you know, about this. Again, it's not about Ryan. You know, it's about the fact that the way the process works is that one quote is written a certain way, and then the whole, you know, season is put into question. And that's what I have a problem with, you know, which goes from Wick Grosbeck down to the ball boys and the guys doing the laundry. And that's the problem that I have with it, because, well, I think that,
but
certainly there are parts of the season that we all have, you know, find objectionable. But at the same time,
but let's
I don't like the idea that the team is being held accountable at any greater level than what other teams are doing, and that's the problem I have.
Right, if David Stern can't figure it out on his own without the quote in the newspaper, then there really should be no issue, because they shouldn't be using media as a politicking point for managing, you know, what is and what isn't. They should have their own processes in place ahead of time.
But they didn't, you know, and they would have called him in and talked about what he said. But they've got to protect their image. And when somebody writes something and quotes a player, and the player says something that impugns the integrity of the game, they at least have to follow up. I think that's fair.
Yeah,
now, the other side of this coin, and I think you guys are bouncing all around it without actually saying it directly, I think maybe Jughead, you did mention, well, you know, the writers... What the rest of what Ryan said didn't fit into their article, and we're always going to have that. Writers are looking for something sensational. They're looking for something to sell newspapers. They were looking for a story on tanking, and they grabbed a few quotes from Ryan, threw it out there, and everybody jumped on it, and it made for some, you know, a sensational headline. But
let's also talk about the role of the discerning fan and much more educated fan that the internet has allowed to happen, and not to mention the Celtics being right at the forefront of that. I mean, we dissect and chop up information so scrupulously that, I mean, honestly, you know, traditional media is just going through an adjustment period right now. And I can't, you know, I can't say that I fault them as they're trying to figure that, you know, how that all plays in. Because like you said, I mean, they're competing with bloggers. So, you know, to a certain point, they have to be breaking some, you know, almost have to be more sensational, I guess.
Well, it must drive the teams crazy, too.
Right.
On the one hand, you know, we can bring out facts that smooth something over and put the team in a better light. On the other hand, as we're going to get into what Ian Thompson wrote, we can take some things that the mainstream press would never touch and really embarrass the team with all the scrutiny, too. Things that, you know, nobody would
like
have thought.
Like bone on bone.
Well, that was one, but this thing about the Celtics not having, you know, any advanced scouts and that other GMs around the league consider the Celtics at a loss in making trades, we're going to have some fun with that a little later in the show, and that's something that would have been lost. You know, Ian Thompson wrote it in Sports Illustrated.
But he wrote that as almost... I don't know. It was like a major point of his story, but at the same time, his statement was really kind of throwaway because he never actually clarified or specified what he meant. He just kind of made
bottom of his story, but he got right to it.
But he didn't say how the structure of the team was. He didn't say that so and so probably, you know, fills in this role with a little help from this guy and or anything like that. He didn't really talk about how the organization does it. He just said that there's no scouts. And all you have to do is go look at the Celtics media guide and say, oh, I don't see any Celtics scouts here. But that doesn't mean that somebody isn't functioning in the role. And I'm not convinced that Ian Thompson did the background check on that to make sure that somebody with the Celtics organization was functioning in the role. And unfortunately, by the time I got a chance to think about that, and I knew that this was going to develop into a hot topic. It was already into the weekend, but I did send an email to the Celtics organization, which I hope to get an answer on, which is to say, you know, how do you address this? You know, nobody seems to have talked about it, but, you know, is there somebody that functions in this role? Like somebody like Chris Wallace, for instance, you know? I'd be surprised.
There is one scout listed, and I went to a couple of different message boards today and posted on the topic and went through a couple of the old threads. And I'm looking at Celtics blog, for instance. Well, we have a call. Maybe we'll get into this later, but I'll just make the point that it was Lucky 17 who did go to the Celtics site, NBA.com, and found Paul Pressey listed as an advanced scout.
Right.
Now, that got rebutted a little later by E.H. Monroe and so on as to what Paul Pressey actually does. But we'll get to that later. Let's take the call.
All right. Welcome to Celtics Stuff Live. You're on the air.
Howdy.
Howdy. Who's on the line?
This is Brett. I'm calling from Salem, New Hampshire. I'm a first time. Hey, I got to tell you what, though. Big compliment coming you guys' way. I've never called in before because you guys make me look forward to Mondays. That's like my Celtic Stuff Live day.
Excellent. You know what I mean? Very glad to hear that.
So, I mean, you know, normally people contemplate suicide on Mondays in their cubes, but I just listen to you guys, you know?
Well, thank you. That's a great compliment. Very nice
to
hear it.
I wanted to talk about, I've been meaning to talk about Danny Ainge. This advanced scout stuff is, whether it's true or not, it's no surprise to me if it's true, because Danny Ainge is horrible, just horrible. Here's everybody, the argument everybody makes about Doc Rivers is what is the argument that needs to be made about Danny Ainge. What do we say about Doc? We say, you know, during the 3 years or 4 years of rebuilding and stuff like that, he's pretty good, but he's not the guy that's going to get us to the next level. I say the same is true of Danny. It's been 4 years. Yeah, he drafts well, and that's great, but he does not sign free agents well at all. He's really horrible with free. Mark Blount, way to go, buddy. Scalabrine, I know the money's not ridiculous, and we all made way too big a deal out of it when he was signed. But, I mean, Scalabrine is overpaid. And then the biggest thing is trades, all right? Ricky Davis, the first time bringing him here, good. First Twan trade, horrible. I mean, the Wally trade, horrible. He could have had the original deal, from what I heard on, I mean, from what I read everywhere, was Blount and Banks for Candy, which is brilliant. But then the idiot throws in Wally and Ricky. Like, I mean, obviously we're building for the future down the line. What do you want, a 31-year-old Wally when you're ready to compete, or like a 29-year-old Ricky? It's ridiculous. So what I say is, the hell with all the Doc Rivers stuff. Danny's not the guy that is going to bring us to the next level. Not at all. Ditch him now and bring in a guy that's going to make those astute tweaks, just like my boy up in Toronto. What the heck's that guy's name? I forget his name.
Colangelo.
And then bam. Yeah, we're in there. No GM is going to mess up this draft, even if we do land at like 3, 4, or 5. We don't need Danny for drafting. We need somebody that's going to tweak it and make it real. Know
that's
what I mean?
Great.
Okay. Well, let me ask you a couple questions here, Colin. So your main concern with them is trades, but are you ignoring his drafting? I mean, do you basically think is, you know, did Al Jefferson draft himself? Or I mean,
No.
You think that's the biggest part of how this team's been put together?
Exactly.
I agree, that's what I'm saying.
That's his strength, right? I don't argue that.
Absolutely.
Drafting and scouting the college level is his strength. But is that what we need right now? Is that direction that we're continuing to go? No, it's not. Everybody says now's the time to win, and now's the time to make that perfect veteran signing / trade to throw with the core guys, the core young guys, and Paul and Al, and then bam, we're in there, right?
I think you're absolutely right, though. I think you're right that we've gone as far as we can with the idea of building through the draft, basically. You're right.
Yep.
The time has moved on. You've got to get something from trades, definitely. But
and do you trust Danny?
But the problem is you're ignoring what's gotten us to this point. I mean, without the last 3 years, you wouldn't be at the point where you could make those trades. I mean, look where we were. Are we going to trade Eric Williams and Tony Petit for junk? I mean, that's where we were, you know. And I think with, you know, forgetting that, you know, that just we are where we are. And I agree with you. We're not a better team now than we were 3 years ago. The record proves it. But certainly, to ignore the drafting is only telling half the story. I mean,
I'm not trying to tell the story. I'm not trying to like demean what he did as far as drafting. I mean, I think he's slightly overrated, but I mean, he's an A plus scout. He's a great scout. But I think his trades 90% of them are horrible.
I'd like to go after that a little bit with you, and I don't know that anybody, you know, will have a definitive answer. These are subjects that can be argued about for 3-4 days running, but the first set of trades he made, you know, to bring in Payton and bring Walker back, you know, he's working with a coach and ownership. The ownership wanted to make the playoffs that year, interrupted his rebuilding process. He brought in a couple of veterans. The next year, I think those trades to get rid of Blount and Ricky Davis were to get rid of players that had stopped listening to the coach. I would say that the pressure came from Doc Rivers to make that move. He wanted another scorer, another shooter to complement Pierce outside. They, you know, presumably had no way of knowing that Wally's knee was going to crack down. He's a pretty good player. People were booing Blount out of town. He had shut down on the coach. And then the last trade, the LaFrentz deal, Mike Gorman told us, and it wasn't any secret, he said it right on the air, that Danny would have made that trade for he and I, he said.
The point was
to get rid of the $15 million.
So what did he do? What did he do? He undid a mistake 4 years ago with another mistake when we never should have Telfair. I'd rather have Rafe LaFrentz. If we're trying to make a run to the playoffs this year, I don't want the ghost of Theo Ratliff. I would rather have Rafe LaFrentz
Brandon Ryan on my team. Wait a minute. You may want that, but ownership told Danny in no uncertain terms to get rid of that contract. They wanted that $15 million to pay
because
Jefferson
and
Delonte West.
He was the idiot who brought that albatross here in the first place.
Well, whatever. Danny was told to get rid of him.
Let me jump in a little bit. I just want to
get rid of him, and he saved the team a lot of money, which will keep them out of luxury tax. Now, you know, the real question going forward is whether or not the ownership is going to allow Danny to use Ratliff's expiring contract to make a major trade, and I don't think they will. And are we going to blame Danny for that?
I'm not going to blame him for that, but I'm going to blame him for the trade in the first place, and I'm going to blame him for having to give up the seventh pick to undo a mistake he made 3 years earlier.
Well, let me jump.
3 years.
Yeah, let me jump in on this, Brett, because I'm really enjoying your call quite a lot, to be honest with you, and I'm glad you called in and don't mind the fact that maybe we disagree with you because
used to it. Believe me.
Yeah. I'll tell you what, Brett. I don't
disagree 100%. Brett.
Well, hold on.
And as I said, coming in, you know, there's good points behind what you're saying, and I think equally behind what I'm saying, and I'm just, you know, giving the other side to that argument.
Right, but let me develop that a little bit, JB, because there's a little bit of a difference between where we were then and where we are now, and with both of the shows, and I mean both of the shows, both of the trades, and you know, so I guess what I'm kind of wanting to draw out here is the fact that, you know, when we did the original Rafe LaFrentz trade, we got West and Allen. And the whole point at that time was the team was trying to acquire assets and, you know, basically turn the roster over from a bunch of aging, you know, medium-level exception veterans and start to acquire some assets. And so to do that, to get those draft picks and everything else, they had to take on salary. I think by the time you roll around to this past draft when they made the trade for Telfair, they were at a point where they knew of those talent, you know, of those young assets and talented players that they developed, who they wanted to keep, and they needed to have money to be able to re-sign those guys. Unfortunately, while we would all love them to just, you know, hold on to these, you know, players like Rafe LaFrentz or just cut them or do whatever, and, you know, we're, as fans, we're not really so concerned about the fiscal end of things just because, you know, we want a quality product out there. And, you know, I think, you know, on the, you know, on the perimeter, you look at Brandon Roy and you look at Sebastian Telfair, and you don't really care about the year's money that you saved. But I think from a, you know, from an administrative standpoint, you know, as far as Danny Ainge's responsibility to the organization and his job, he kind of did have a responsibility to bring them, bring the team to a fiscal level where they had a chance to make a decision about the money at this point, where they had the option. Because, you know, really, Ratliff's contract hasn't expired. It won't expire until next, you know, after next season. And they have the opportunity to extend a number of players this year, where they will extend on to after next year. So the timing works out really well. But if the team does want to spend more money, as in, you know, the amount of money that they would have saved 2 years from now with Rafe and Wally, if they want to spend some of that, then they can deal Ratliff as the salary filler and some of these young prospects to do that, thus eliminating the need to extend some of them and lessening the hit of the finances. But it's really about flexibility. They didn't have any flexibility in trade back then without making what would appear on the surface as bad trades. They had to take on bad salaries to acquire assets. And now you're right. They do have to undo some of that. They absolutely have to undo some of that. But during that time, they got a chance to take a look at a lot of the players who they wanted to keep, and they've got the, you know, the team in a position to compete towards the future. So I just keep that in mind a little bit.
I understand he's now in the beginning of the year, well actually for several years, I've been like, I like totally hate Danny, like more than I do, more than I probably sound like I do now, because I had no hope until Al showed up. You know what I mean? Like I always knew, just like everybody else, you know, that Al could be what we're starting to see, but I was starting to doubt whether or not it came. So ever since Al, and then I love Tony Allen, what he did, but we only saw seven games of that. You know what I mean? Let's not pen him in for Springfield, but Al is special. So I have kind of changed my tune a little bit on Danny. I can appreciate what he did and the core that he brought in here, young guys. We definitely have stuff going on, but I have seen horrible trades, and you guys can argue that, you know, Theo gives us flexibility and stuff, and that's fine, sure, but when it comes down to it, no matter how big a Danny supporter you are, you can't point at like one or two trades, and this guy's made like nine, and say that was a grand slam trade. Well done. He gets abused on the trade market, and what we need right now is we don't have to trade for even a Rashard Lewis, which is like a second tier. We just need one perfect trade, a good draft pick, and a couple tweaks. You know what I mean? But I don't trust Danny to do that. We can do better. There are GMs out there, and there are assistant GMs that can come in here and do a better job than Danny. Can they draft better than Danny? No, they cannot. Danny is top-notch, but that's not what we need to get to the next level.
I see what you're saying, almost like two phases of the equation. You think Danny did what you wanted him to do, which was to acquire the talent, and now that it's time to trade, you want another GM to come in.
And he could have done it quicker. He could have done it quicker, by the way, because, yeah, the first Tuan trade brought in Allen and West, and I beg to differ on that. People love to say it brought in Allen and West. It did not. What it did was bring in Chris Mills, who then, along with Mike James, who is a pretty darn good player himself, went to Detroit, and then that became whether or not it is West or Allen. I forget which pick. But people love to say, oh, that trade brought in West and Allen. No, it did not. It was part of another trade that later on happened. You know what I mean? Like, it's like the knee bone's connected to the hip bone kind of thing, and everybody loves to say that, you know, it's that one trade brought in all these great players. No, it didn't. You know what I mean? Like, and also, like, all his other trades, people love to just list all the trades and all the flips and basically say, like, see, this is what happened. We got all these players. Well, no, we didn't. First of all, we waited 4 years to assemble all these players. So it's like if I acquire player A and then 9 years later turn him into player B, who is a Hall of Famer, was that a good trade? No, because I went through 9 years of torture. You know what I mean? These 4 years for me have been torture. You know what I'm saying?
I guess we're going, Derek.
We kind of look back and we look back and we kind of say, oh, well, well done, but it really wasn't as great as we had hoped. And if Danny had made an astute trade in the beginning, he could, we look what they did 1 year later with Tuan Dallas. They get the pick that became Devin Harris and Jason Terry, who is like obviously helping. Well, he's not helping him too much in this series, but Jason Terry is a real player, and Devin Harris. Both of those guys would be starters on this squad right now. You know what I mean?
Yeah, but so, they didn't want to pay the money, and you can't blame Danny for ownership.
They didn't want to pay money?
We could have had Jason
Terry. They wanted to pay Rafe.
We could have had Jason Terry here also, but he wanted like a 5-year deal. And I don't know what Dallas wound up paying him, but they're paying about $30 million in luxury tax, which our ownership would never pay. And I'll go back to that point. We can both agree, you know, that some of these trades are doubtful. Some
exactly.
of them were very good because Danny is building through the draft a young team. He doesn't want older players who don't get it or who will never get it. But, and my major point at the beginning was that he's under the constraints of ownership, and they've given him a budget, and they've told him how much they'll spend and when they'll spend it, and he has to work within that. But, boy, you surely are a knowledgeable fan, and we've very much enjoyed having you call, Derek. And please call back anytime. It's been great.
Oh, thanks, fellas. And it's Brett, but not Derek.
Brett. Yeah, it's Brett. We're up against the break, Brett, but I just want to echo JB's sentiments. Even though we disagree, your call was a lot of fun. One of the
Thanks
most
so
fun
much,
calls
fella.
We've had in weeks. So looking forward to hearing from you again.
Oh, absolutely, guys. Take care.
You too. Thank you.
And when we come back from break, we're going to have Elrod Enchilada. And, you know, maybe he'll pipe in on this topic a little bit. Good stuff. See you after the break.
Celtic Stuff Live is brought to you by Garber Family Dentistry in Salem, Mass. Garber Family Dentistry is a practice that treats both children and adults using modern equipment. That includes intraoral cameras so that you can see what they see, and digital radiography. That's 90% less radiation than conventional x-rays. They also use sedation for people who experience anxiety during dental procedures. That's Garber Family Dentistry. Give them a call, 978-744-8495.
Go ahead, thank you, one now, 50 last call, sold a million one, thank you, bidder number 225.
Allen Auction Company, specializing in distinctive properties and municipal auction services. Using innovative sales and marketing strategies, they ensure that the auction day experience is both positive and profitable. Visit their website, allenauction.com, or call 781-592-8100.
Oh, guys.
Is this a Bulls vlogger or Elrod, that song?
I'm just enjoying this show so much. I couldn't think of a more appropriate way to come back from break.
Well, I applaud. It's very nice.
And
shout out and congratulations to the Bulls vlogger. He's joined us. I imagine he's still sober, hasn't gone out yet to celebrate the sweep. The sweep! Miami Heat.
Well, let's bring on our next guest. It's Elrod Enchilada. You might know him as Bob. Bob, welcome to the show. We're very happy to have you, and it was a great article you wrote last week.
Well, thanks. It's a pleasure to be on the air, and it's I love going to the message board or whatever we call this. These are some really smart fans. It's a pleasure to be with all of you.
Well, thank you.
Yeah, I love the people in the pit. It's like the diehards from every board, and you know, they keep it going in there. And every time you think you might miss a point or somebody might miss a point, there's always somebody in there to keep us on point. So, yeah, no doubt. Elrod, why don't you talk a little bit about the article that you wrote last week? We discussed it probably 20 to 30 minutes of the show last week, and I still don't think we've got to every single player that. That you discussed in the article, but I thought maybe you might pull out what you saw as maybe the most important points that you made.
Well, I think the reason I wrote the piece the way I did and when I did, which is to go through the 10 young players on the roster and evaluate what sort of season they had and what we learned from it and what we can project their future course might be. is that I wanted to sort of get that out now because I think it's premature now to do a lot of trade talk until we have a sense of where we're drafting. I think, you know, that's really on hold. So it seemed to me we're in this sort of phony war period till May 22nd when it's time maybe to stand back and take stock of what we have. And then after May 22nd, we can go into the aggressive GM mode, consider the sort of deals, trades, draft picks we might want to consider to make the team stronger next year. So that was the spirit behind the deal. It seemed like that was one thing we could do right now is go through our existing panel, especially the young players, and see what we had to deal with there. And, you know, I find that the way I understand players, and when I've evaluated young players in the league for 30 years, you know, every year you learn a little bit more about them and you have a firmer sense of what sort of career they're going to have. And usually most players by the fourth, fifth, sixth year pretty much lock into what sort of career they're going to have. There are occasional exceptions to that. But sometimes with a young player, they'll play pretty well the first year or two, then they're out of the league in a year or two. They not only don't improve, they get worse. Their first year is their best year. That can happen to a guy like Allen Ray. A player like that could be out of the league in 2 years. Brandon Hunter probably had his best year his first year. So you really, the first year doesn't give you a lot of information. So I thought I would speculate, based on the information we had, where these 10 young guys might be in 3 or 4 years based on what we've seen and what the odds were. And that was the premise behind the story. And I thought when you looked at the Celtics that way, it was a pretty more hopeful picture than the 24-win record would have suggested. That you looked at the sort of talent they had and the quantity of talent, and it looks like down the road there's a reasonable chance this will be the core of a fairly talented team. Now, that doesn't mean anything. We don't need more talent or we don't have to make trades, but just that the base of talent that's being built here is impressive, and I think extremely impressive when compared to any other period in recent Celtic history. I compared it to what the team Ainge inherited, and on that team that he inherited, despite the glorious run of 2002 that people love to invoke, the team he inherited in 2003 had one great player, had only two or three other players who were really had much market value, and then had like seven or eight guys who you couldn't even give away their jock straps.
Yeah, and that team had certainly passed its prime, and we're talking about penurious owners. That's when they were forced to trade for Vin Baker to save $1 million for the outgoing owner. I think Kenny Anderson went out in that trade, Potapenko. He wouldn't sign Rodney Rogers. And by that playoff loss to the Nets, Walker had lost all of his lift. Kenyon Martin was eating him for lunch. And Pierce, New Jersey, had developed a defense against him. He was chucking bricks. I mean, the team was pitiful, and I have to agree 100%. We'd all seen
it
enough.
It had no future at all.
The owners,
no future. That was the thing.
The owners were so disgusted themselves that they announced Ainge after Game 3, before the series was even over, which is unprecedented.
Well, you know, one of the joys of my life was that for a number of years, all the sort of anger and frustration I would feel in any segment of my life could be taken out on Thanks Dad Gaston, who might have been the single biggest moron owner ever. You know, he was just so unimpressive. And, you know, people criticize Whit Grusbeck for putting monetary constraints in Danny. I really haven't seen that as being much of a factor yet. But I'm telling you, Whit Grusbeck looks like Mark Cuban on steroids compared to Thanks Dad Gaston.
Yeah, he did a job here, and I guess, you know, the word is that he got disillusioned, that he came in and gave Pitino a lot of money, and Pitino sold him a bill of goods, perhaps. Pitino didn't work as hard as some people think he should have. The whole thing went up in smoke, and he decided at that point, every man for himself, he was going to make some money and get out, like a disillusioned lover.
Yeah, remember the real low point came in the year that Thanks Dad refused to let Wallace spend the MLE. I think it was his last year, 02.
On Rodney?
And they only, for that, but yeah, or re-sign Rodney or go out and get someone new at the MLE. And so what Thanks Dad would allow Wallace to do was to sign Ruben Wolczewski, who was like, you know, the backup, like, utility infielder on the Argentine B-League team. And that was his only free agent we could bring in. This was off of the team that went to the Eastern Finals that theoretically was starting to make its push.
Yeah, it was almost as if he was apprenticing with the Jacobs family, spending too much time in the Garden Skybox there, or was it because of the Fleet Center in those days? But, yeah, that probably was the absolute bottom low point, at least since the Sidney Wicks, Curtis Rowe era.
You know, the reason why the Sidney Wicks era wasn't such a low point, it was a low point then, but it only lasted for, like, 2 years. And so, this one has been like a long hell, and that was sort of, in the midst of it. And I think that was the downside.
Yeah, they bounced back pretty fast, but at the time it happened, we were so used to dominance.
That's right.
And it just came as such a shock to have so many selfish, overplayed, me-first players running around in green jerseys. It was a real turnoff. And poor Dave Cowens.
Right.
I think it probably took 5 or 10 years off of Dave's life trying to coach and play with that bunch. What do you got to say about Sebastian Telfair, Elrod?
Well, if you saw the piece, I wrote the piece about Sebastian before his speeding ticket, I think, or before he got thrown off the team. At any rate, I thought Sebastian Telfair was just an astonishingly bad player this year, and we've talked about it before. What surprised me with Telfair, watching him play, was just how little game the guy had. I was misled into thinking he was going to be really a first-rate playmaking point guard, a New York City point guard in the Mark Jackson, Tiny Archibald mold, who could get anywhere on the court with the ball and find open guys. And the weak spot of his game is going to be that he didn't have a shot. I mean, like all these guys, and they have to learn to develop some sort of outside jumper to keep defenses honest, like we're talking about Rondo. And instead I saw a guy who in the half court really had hardly any vision I could see. He was not a playmaker at all and couldn't play any defense. And for all the talk about how super fast he is, I really didn't see it. I'm not saying he's slow.
You're opening.
But I rarely looked at him. He was the first super fast 21-year-old point guard I thought had to lose weight.
Yeah, your opening quote was telling. What we learned this year, Telfair was a revelation. After all the hype, it was a shock to see just how lousy a player he was. And, I think the first couple of months I thought he looked okay, and Danny was quoted recently as saying, that they changed their offense and it wasn't suited to him. And he obviously needs to be able to just, take the reins and do it his way. My concern is I'm worried that Sebastian Telfair has lost all of the confidence that it takes for him to step forward. Now, I know he's only 21, so there's time for him to get it back. But I'm really concerned about this kid's ego, because I think it's a major part of more than many players, it's one of the most major components to his effectiveness on the court.
I think you're right. And there was an interview with him that really turned me off to his likely future in Boston and maybe as a professional basketball player about 2 months ago. I think it was Mike Gorman, or it might have been one of the beat reporters, who had a story on Telfair and how he was dealing with the fact that he hadn't been getting any playing time for like 6 weeks except for garbage time. And, they said, Sebastian, do you understand why you're not playing? And he said, no, I don't. It doesn't make any sense to me. I thought I was playing just fine before. And when he said that, I'm going, wow, this guy really doesn't get it. I mean, to compare that to, like, most really good players, and they're not playing well, or they're the toughest critics on themselves. They're saying, yeah, I'm just not getting it done here. I've really got to kick it in the ear. I'm getting out there working my game. His attitude was, I thought I did pretty well. I think I should still be playing. And that said to me, this guy doesn't quite understand the way great players and NBA players have to push themselves to get their game into gear to make it in this league. And if you're a 5'10", not especially athletically gifted guy, you especially have to work at your game.
Yeah, and I just want to quote one more thing from your article about Telfair. Is you posted this on the 22nd, so, and I'm sure you wrote that days before then, so I'm pretty sure you didn't. You didn't have any idea about what was going to come in the following week, but you said, where is he going? Out of town. He has almost no market value, and his legal problems have put him on the Orion Green Express. Ironically, all reports are that Telfair is a stand-up guy and a great teammate who has overcome obstacles that would have paralyzed most people. He may eventually make it, but it will be many years from now and in a different town. Even if the Seas keep him, there's no way he is taking minutes from Rondo or West. So,
a little bit more prophetic than maybe you expected it to be.
Well, yeah, I just, you know, I think, you know, this whole thing with the speeding ticket and the gun are a little bit unfortunate also in the sense that, I mean, that analysis of Telfair is just based on how he plays. And I think he was on the way out of town, even if he had, you know, not gotten arrested and not had a gun in his car. He didn't have a future here. This just sort of, for whatever reason, forced the hand of it. And it's unfortunate. I do think, going back to the caller who just called in before, Derek, I guess it was, you know, this was a terrible
trade
Danny made.
Sorry, JB got his name wrong, so I'm just jumping in. It was Brett.
Brett, okay, sorry, JB. Yeah, you and I are on the same page. You know, I think that this trade clearly was the worst trade Danny made by far, and the one that, this was the only trade he made that when he made it, and I was out of the country, so I didn't write on it at the time, but when he made it, it smelled to me like one of those Patino trades. Patino would make these trades. Remember, he made the deal for Kenny Anderson, and then he made the deal for Potapenko. And in each trade, you know, he rushed to make these deals, and he way overpaid for these guys. And he acted at the press conference like he'd somehow stolen these guys from the rest of the league. You know, hey, I managed to swing Potapenko. But no one was competing with him for these guys. No one else wanted Potapenko or Kenny Anderson. The teams that were trading were delighted to find someone to take him and give away Chauncey Billups and give away the draft pick that became Andre Miller or would have been Sean Marion. And so this is the first trade Danny made where I said, my God, you know, he really paid a lot for someone. No one in the league seems to really want that badly. No one was competing to get this guy.
Can you imagine, Elrod, let's say Danny doesn't do the deal with Phoenix for Rondo. Imagine the fallout right now. I mean, that's the thing that, you know, we haven't really given a lot of thought to, because I think a lot of us, that night it just happened, bing, bang, and all of a sudden we had a point guard, and then we had two, and, you know, it all shifted out as the season progressed, and we saw what a loser Telfair was on the court. But, you know, without that deal for Rondo, this season could have taken a very – I mean, I'm an unabashed Rondo fan. Without a doubt, I'm a big fan of Rajon Rondo. But, it's if you go back and think, certainly without Rajon Rondo, this season I think would take a whole different complexion. And he's someone who helped me get a lot of joy and put a lot of positive thoughts into next year. And from looking at your ratings here, I think you have a pretty strong opinion of Rajon as well.
You know, I agree with your analysis. I haven't put it that well before, but I think you're absolutely right in the way you assess it, that you know, had he not drafted Rondo, it could have, yeah. The idea that you would have had Telfair clutching around out there, Alan Ray getting minutes when West is Turk, it would have been a really, really painful year. So in a way, that wonderful draft pick of Rondo, which again is a classic case of demonstrating Danny's genius at its best, getting a guy that no one else in the league really seemed to think that much of, and going out and getting him like that was extraordinary, and it saved the season. You know, I love Rondo, and I think Rondo, I think only Heinsohn loves Rondo more than me. Since we got Rondo.
Mike MD.
Well, right, you know, Mike D from NP and Koozie maybe too, but other than that, Elrod, you could have the fifth slot. You two can battle it out.
Okay.
Well, I think Heinsohn, you know, has been able to cut back in his Viagra since Rondo joined the team. The guy's like all over the microphone as soon as Rondo's on the floor.
Elrod, I just wanted to go back though. You know, obviously Telfair didn't work out, and Ratliff never played a minute, but In the context that the trade was made, and when you know that Danny had Rondo number 7 in his book and rated him higher than any of the players that were going to be available to us, and he knew that he could get him later, and the ownership was telling him to get out of LaFrenz's deal and save the $15 million, he brought in what looked to be just what we needed in the defensive shot-blocking veteran big man underneath in Theo Ratliff, who would have been fabulous here if he could have played the 15, 20 minutes a game that we were hoping for. And secondly, he brought in 2 point guards. He wanted to change the mentality of the team. He wanted the team to be up-tempo. We wanted to take the ball out of Delonte West's hands and stop the ISO plays that were dominating and slowing down and stifling our offense. And he made that move on 3 levels. Not only did he save the $15 million, which is going to come in real handy to sign Jefferson and West and or to be used in a sign and trade, he definitely did bring in the 2 point guards, which changed the mentality of the team and gave us, you know, some look at up tempo and probably brought Gerald Green out quite a bit more than he would have. And lastly, the opportunity to get Theo Ratliff, who would have been a much better fit here than Rafe LaFrentz, and you know, unfortunately, neither of them played. LaFrentz played so sparingly for Portland, he might as well have sat out the entire season like Ratliff did. So I'm not sure that I look at it quite as negatively as you do, even though Brandon Roy did turn out to be a Rookie of the Year.
No, and I think your analysis is nice and it's fair, and I think the other thing we have to keep in mind is that I think Danny thought the draft was pretty bad, except for a few guys like Rondo. And I don't think he held Roy or Foy or the guys that Rudy Gay, the next few guys who were taken, Sene Seke, that guy up in Seattle, I don't think he thought any of those guys were players. I remember that an interview with Danny during the Portland game in January when they beat Portland to end their losing streak and Tony Allen had that phenomenal game. And Danny was in the booth for a quarter with Tommy and Mike. And he was talking about that deal and Brandon Roy. And he said, look, I think Brandon Roy's going to have a good career. Not a great career. He's not an all-star, but he's going to be a good player. And the way he said it suggested to me that he didn't think Brandon Roy was going to be a better player than the guys he already had collected to play the wing position. I'm not saying that he's right, but I think that was his assessment of Brandon Roy. And, you know, what I think in retrospect would have been nice is if Danny would have, instead of taking Telfair, if he's going to unload the number 7 pick, because he doesn't really think there's someone there who can fit on the roster that well, in addition to dumping some salary, just get a number 1 for next year. Get something else down the road. But don't take on, you know, someone like Telfair, because he really, I mean, it's hard for me to see how someone could have watched him in Portland and then said, this guy's worth a number 7 pick, even in a bad draft.
In hindsight, that's probably right. But on the other hand, you know, nobody knew he was going to get into trouble. And if you looked at him in summer league and you saw some of those passes he made with the guys running the wing and that pass he made from the foul line when he spun 360 and hit Ryan Gomes in full stride at the other foul line, you know, you had to see something there that opened your eyes. And you figured he was going to be around for 3 or 4 years, and maybe by year 3, by year 4, he would have been a very good point guard, even if not the starter, a nice guy to have on your bench. But let's move on. I wanted to go about your ratings a little bit and wondered why. I think you've been a little bit hard on my guy Ryan Gomes. You think he has less chance of being a solid starter than Kendrick Perkins, for instance. You know, I think Ryan is a player. He's just getting used to the small forward position. You pointed out, rightly so, he's increased his range. You talked about his quickness issues at the three defensively. Do we have a better defensive three on the roster right now? And isn't that something that he can work on, and with his work ethic and his smarts? Do you think you maybe were a little harsh?
You seem to. I know you like Ryan. I like Ryan's game too. I think actually I was trying to be conservative in all my prognostications. I was trying to err slightly on the conservative side, and probably to non-Boston fans, they'd look at that and think I'm a crazy Kool-Aid drinker. But I didn't want it, someone to look at it and think, oh, this guy's just crazy. I think the issue with Ryan is that, you know, what's exciting here is the more he extends range on that jumper and he gets comfortable with it. Right now, what Ryan also sees, in addition to extending range, he's got to be a lot more comfortable catching it and shooting it right away. He still doesn't have a quick enough shot. And if he can get the speed of your shot off as well as extending his range, then I think he's going to become a very good offensive player. But the problem, I think, is I think he has to be at the three. I just don't see him playing the four. I just don't think he's got what it takes defensively at the four, outside of offense. Offensively, I think he'll be able to do whatever he wants if he's shooting from the outside, and he can bang a little bit. And then the question is, can he play really good defense at the three? I think he may be able to, but he's always going to have quickness issues, especially with some of the really great threes in the league. Could he be a solid starter? Yeah, he can be a solid starter. And where did I put him at? I gave him
a three. You gave Perkins
a three in ten chance. Well, that's not that bad. Basically a 1 in 3 chance.
Yeah, but Perkins
a serious
got a
rotation
four.
Guy. And I think the serious rotation guys, I mean, I think he's a guy who can play 25 minutes a night, be your third forward off the bench, and be really good on a winning team. And I think there's nothing wrong with that. That's what he's pretty close to now. And I think that's likely where he's going to end up. But if he can extend the range, get your shot off a little quicker, build up his, get a little bit better, yeah, he can be a solid starter. And when I put these things down for a solid starter, serious rotation guy, I didn't mean like on the worst team in the league. I meant on teams that actually would get in the playoffs and do well.
Well, I wanted to finish up quick, and I know Justin's ready to jump in on me, but I wrote an article, I don't know, 4 or 5 months ago, comparing him to Havlicek, and one of my last points was that Havlicek wasn't Havlicek for the first 3 or 4 years that he was here, and he had the same knock. He didn't have much of a jump shot. He wasn't very athletic. He was a little bit too slow, and what were you going to do with him except make him a sixth man? And that's all I'll say, and turn it over to Jughead.
Let me answer that, because actually I read that piece and I liked it a lot. And I checked Hondo's statistics for the first 2 years, and I thought the statistics, I mean, his scoring shooting percentage was that low, but his scoring per minute by his second year was a lot higher than Ryan's probably ever will be. But the player I think he compares to, and I wrote a piece on this that got shot down by everyone, but the player I think he's mostly like is Don Nelson. Don, they have a similar body type, sort of a similar, very heady game, swing forward, nice shot. I mean, the times have changed, and there are obviously differences, but I think he's a little bit closer to Don Nelson. I think that's the sort of career I could see Ryan having, and maybe a little better career than Don Nelson. There's nothing wrong with having a Don Nelson career.
No.
As a coach.
I was going to say, some of these fans may want to have Ryan do the player coach thing, if that's the case there, Elrod. I wanted to go to your assessment of Gerald Green, and I liked the line here. Gerald Green remains an enigma wrapped in a riddle drowning in a sea of confusion. looking at the scoring here, you could have put him anywhere between second and seventh, and I think you fairly put him fourth, probably right in the middle. I don't know what to make of the guy. I don't think anyone else does. I think some people think the guy is going to be fantastic, and across, you know, between Reggie Miller and this guy and that guy and this guy, or he could flame out and be, you know, Kedrick Brown. I think he's going to be better than Kedrick Brown no matter what. But, you know, what can you make of Gerald Green? I mean, certainly you think that there's almost a similar shot he has of being a solid starter as being a serious rotation guy, and a 2 in 10 chance of being an all-star, 20%. That's not bad, but boy, he's a tough one to peg.
Yeah, and every year you learn a little bit more, and hopefully a year from now I'll have a better sense. My general feeling about Gerald Green is that he's going to really require patience. I mean, I think he's a guy, and I use this example in the piece, like Gerald Wallace, who came out of college after his first year with wondrous athletic ability. Not quite Gerald's athletic ability, but still quite, you know, very impressive. But not much of a clue about how to play the game. In his first 2 years in the league of Sacramento, didn't play very much and didn't do much when he did play. And now he's come on and had put together a pretty nice career in Charlotte. I mean, I think he's 25 or so. And I think, you know, that might be the path for Gerald. He's just going to need a little more time because he doesn't have a real sense of how to play the game of basketball. He doesn't, you know, one of the things people compare him to Tracy McGrady, well, I went back and looked at McGrady's statistics his first 2 or 3 years in the league, and while McGrady wasn't, you know, playing a lot of minutes, and he wasn't scoring 25 points a game. He didn't do that till he got to Orlando. He was getting extraordinary rebounding, block shots, steals on a per-minute basis. I mean, he was just all over the floor. You know, the guy knew – he wasn't just a great athlete. He really knew how to make plays on the floor when he was out there, positive plays. I haven't seen enough of that, Gerald. I mean, he does it a little bit. And he might be able to develop it, but it doesn't come naturally to him. At least it doesn't come easily to him, if not naturally. And that, I just think we have to give him a lot of time, and it might never come. But, you know, he's such a phenomenal athlete, and he has such a lovely shooting stroke that I think we'd be loath to trade him unless we were offered something that really was paying us like he was going to become a great player. Then I think I'd consider it. But for nothing less than that, I certainly wouldn't trade away his upside to get something that's never going to be anywhere near as good.
You know, we wanted to get to the Ian Thompson article for Sports Illustrated before we close with you. But before that, I just wanted to talk a little bit about Tony Allen and just to get some real quick thoughts about that you might have on his rehab. I spoke with him. He's targeting August as a chance to get back on the floor when he's in Vegas, do some rehab, work with some reputable trainers out there. You know, the last injury we saw that it took him, you know, basically 7 or 8 months after he got back on the court before he regained his explosiveness. Some of that was thought to be confidence because we heard him complaining about having some pain some days and not having pain the other days. Then, you know, we all know that Tony is one tough SOB. But, you know, I'm just wondering if you think that that experience is something that he's going to learn from, that he's just going to know what he can do with his knee, and if we'll see some more explosiveness from him sooner this time around, or if you think that having bilateral knee injuries in consecutive years is going to have his rehabilitation extend out and maybe not even see the real Tony Allen till maybe the last couple of weeks of the season next year.
Yeah, I don't know, obviously. I'm hoping for the former. It could be the latter. I'm a little more optimistic, though, because I think that first knee injury had, I mean, I never got a coherent explanation of what that knee injury was. It just seemed like, you know, every time you tried to explain it, it just sounded like, well, they did minor surgery, but it was minor surgery that lingered longer than ACL almost. Whereas this one was pretty cut and dried, what it entailed. And I think for an athlete of Tony Allen's age and athletic ability and physical traits, if he works really hard, there's no reason why he can't, certainly by the beginning of the season, be in, you know, fine shape to play and at the top of his game not too long thereafter. There are a lot of players who have ACLs who do that. That doesn't mean he will. I'll give you one quick example. In the NFL draft yesterday, the third player taken overall was an offensive tackle named Joe Thomas, who had serious ACL surgery in January of this year, and then came, or last year, 2006, and then played his senior year as tackle, and by the end of his senior year, in the last November, December, was playing the greatest offensive tackle apparently anyone's ever played in college football. And so he made a complete recovery in like 10 months, and he was back playing again in 7 months. I'm not saying, and that's not an easy sport to play with the banged up knee any more than basketball is. I'm not saying Tony's going to do that. But for an athlete of that caliber, it's not out of the question that he could actually do it. And I gather he's working like a lunatic. So I'm optimistic. I'm a little concerned, you know, whether Tony's going to regain that momentum. I mean, I think he lost in the shuffle of the season, and why I'm ranked third was just how well he was playing those last 3 weeks.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, it was some of the best basketball outside of Paul Pierce we've seen in this city since the early 90s.
Yeah, I totally agree with you. I want to move to the Ian Thompson article as we're getting a little pressed for time here, and I'm just going to quote what he said. The Celtics, unlike most of their rivals, don't have a pro personnel scout traveling the league and collecting behind-the-scenes information on veterans who may be traded to Boston. Rival teams are fully aware that Boston is vulnerable on trades for NBA talent, but the Celtics have yet to address this weakness in their front office. Do you buy that it's that cut and dry, or do you think that there are guys that just aren't listed in the media guide, except for, I guess, Paul Pressey recently was clarified as a scout for the team? There are other guys that may be traveling and doing some of that work, traveling with the team. Do you think?
Well, you know, I heard your comments on it earlier before I came in the air, and I thought they were appropriate. I mean, I just don't know, and I don't know how much this reporter knows either. I mean, the one bit of evidence that is disconcerting about it is in the Telfair deal, Danny repeatedly went back to the sort of scouting him in high school and how impressive he was in talking about the upside of Telfair. And, you know, I think maybe someone spent a long time watching him, you know, in Portland that second year, might not have had such a glowing scouting report on him. And the one thing we know in scouting is the most recent play is the most pertinent to how to projecting the future, not the oldest play as a rule. But I don't think his other trades fit that description at all. I don't think he was cleaned out because he hadn't done his scouting. I don't think he's traded for anyone who has surprised us because they haven't been what we were expecting when they came. What we've been killed by are the injuries. I mean, we just didn't know about Wally. We didn't know about Theo would have those injuries that necessarily happened. But I don't think a scout gets you that. I think that's a medical report.
Yeah, precisely. Yeah, I think you're right about that. JB, do you want to?
Well, I have a lot of quotes, from around the boards on this issue. I'm not sure that, you know, anything is definitive, and I don't know if we want to, spend the time while Elrod is here for me to read them. I thought I might read them later as we go out. Maybe if we have something else for Elrod besides this topic, we should finish with that.
Elrod, is there a topic that you think that you wanted to bring to light here before we wrap up? We're bumping up on the end of the show, but we obviously go over on a regular basis. So, if there was something that you wanted to talk about, certainly bring it up.
Well, I think the big issues we're going to want to be talking about over the summer, as soon as we know the draft position, obviously is the draft, and we'll be taking what we do in terms of trades. But also key issues that management are going to face this summer is what to do with Al Jefferson, Tony Allen, Delonte West, all three of whom can be given sort of a long-term deal this summer like Perk was last year. And if so, how much we pay? I think they might, I'm not sure of this, but they might even be able to extend Gomes if they want. He's in the second year. He's got a third year coming up. I'm not sure if they extend Ryan, but they can't extend the other three. They could have extended Telfair, but clearly that's not happening. So I think that's an important issue, and what sort of market value these guys have and what the cap implications are going to be is one of the issues we're going to have to be real concerned with. The other issue, though, to return to what was talked about before I got on, discussing Danny's terrible trades, and I think I've already criticized the Telfair deal, and I think JB did a nice job of presenting the other side. I think most of Danny's other trades are defensible. I don't necessarily say they're great deals, but I don't think they're the sort of trades like the guy Dick Vitale trading away, the draft choice between Kevin McHale and Robert Parrish for Bob McAdoo. They weren't of that caliber. They were not terrible trades. There were trades like the ones that give away Chauncey Billups for Kenny Anderson, or the draft pick that became Andre Miller would have been Sean Marion for Vitaly Potapenko. These are not that caliber deals. And I thought in every single one, not in every single one, but in most of the trades he made, he got pretty much the best deal he could get that was on the table that met the needs of the team trying to build through the draft for the future, not trying to win right away. And I think in particular that first deal that everyone seems to think now is the worst trade ever, the first Antoine deal, I'd still make that deal. And I think that was a deal he had to make. I don't think Antoine could stay on the team that year. He made it clear he wanted a max extension. There was no way the Celtics were giving him a max extension. That would have been the stupidest signing since Vin Baker. And he wasn't going to be happy camper if he didn't get it. He had to go. Apparently, we now learn Jim O'Brien wanted him to go. And I don't think there was a huge market. People talk constantly, well, the next year, Dallas was able to trade Antoine and get Jason Terry. Well, they were able to get Jason Terry the next year because Antoine only had 1 year left in his contract. His appeal was as an expiring contract. We didn't have that option when he had 2 years left in his contract. And Atlanta didn't have Jason Terry on the market in the summer of 2003 when they did in the summer of 2004. I don't think there was anything on the – I've never seen any credible evidence Danny had a better deal on the table than the one he got. And, as bad as Ray Sneed became, he gave us a pretty good year that second year he was here. It wasn't like he came in and just totally went into the tank. That second year, he played credible basketball, and it's unfortunate he couldn't have continued that way.
Yeah, I think he played 80 and 81 games his second and third year here, which isn't bad.
Yeah, in the second year, he really was a pretty good player. His third year here, he sucked. I mean, he was an embarrassment on the floor. He just couldn't play. I mean, and clearly, in fairness to Rafe LaFrance, it's not because he wasn't trying hard. It wasn't a skill. But, you know, you just can't play if your knee, you can't run. It's a game that requires using your legs.
Well, we needed rebounding, too, I think, and some defense underneath. Which,
toughness. We needed toughness.
Yeah, and he's not that kind of player. And it's also been pointed out that maybe he wasn't used to the best of his abilities. He's a pick-and-pop player, a pick-and-roll player, and Doc had him out on the perimeter as a bailout three-point shooter. And I think he kind of got tired of that role. And on nights when his shot wasn't falling and he'd be pulled quickly, I think he was another one of the veterans who really was not happy with Doc Rivers.
You know, there are two guys, speaking of toughness, that I write about, as you know, glowingly, and I talk about glowingly in the piece, and that, of course, is Perk and Poe, two guys who I really like a lot. And that doesn't mean I think they're going to be superstars or all-stars, but there's guys I want to keep on the team in some capacity. They aren't guys I want to have throw-ins and deals to other teams. And I think they're never going to be valued as high as the contribution they can make to the team. Perk in particular, I think... You know, this injury this year, I don't know a great deal about plantar fasciitis, but I gather it's really hard to play when you've got it and you're in pain. Perkins' rebounding really plummeted this year on a per-minute basis from his entire career level. It just drops by about 20-25%. And, you know, that Perk, when he's rebounding like he did this year, is a decent player, but Perk rebounding on a per-minute basis like he did last year or the year before is a very, very good player as a defensive center. And I think what we saw with Perkins this year is he can hold his own defensively with most big men in this league and give them a run for his money. His feet move well. He's a solid defensive player. He's getting better. He still makes some of these dumb fouls, like that moving pick foul he makes. It's just the most idiotic foul.
Yeah, but once he has one healthy season, they're going to call it his breakout year. I mean,
agree. I think, the thing people forget about Perk, too, is that, you know, he's not as... You know, he hasn't shown his jump shot at all, and I know he's never going to be Bill Laimbeer out there or Parrish draining 15-footers, but he is not hopeless as a shooter. Now, he's not even going to be as good as Big Al's to come. But, you know, at the line, he goes through phases where he'll hit 15 out of 17 or 25 out of 30. He got a lot better at the line this year once he got going and got healthy. And I think, you know, he's a good passer. I think, you know, I put him down as a 4-10 solid starter. I think, you know, if you've got guys who score around him, you could do a lot worse in the middle than Perk. And, you know, you look at some of the guys like Eaton Thomas and O'Donnell Foyle, who are collecting some pretty big paychecks around the league, and I wouldn't take them over Perk.
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned his feet. I think that's been one real revelation, and maybe... a tribute to Coach Ray in that the way he's moving his feet and getting position on defense, it's almost like a 5-7 year veteran.
Great stuff.
Yep.
So, I mean, I think Perk, I just think he conceivably, if the foot thing gets squared away, he gets his rebounding back up to where it was, where he was in the top 15 in the league and per minute, per 40 minute or whatever, for rebounding, keeps blocking, moving his feet, keeps passing, you know, cuts down on some of the dumb fouls. You know, I think people are going to say, well, Sai's a really good player. And I think sometimes we're too quick to throw guys under the bus, like we were with Al last year and Tony, and maybe with Gerald this year, when they go through a rough stretch, forgetting just how absurdly young these guys are and how much growth most players have when they're 20, 21, 22. And they're nowhere near the end of the growth curve.
All right. Well, we're going to have to let you go, Elrod. But once again, just a great guest on our show. I think we had one of our best shows tonight, and it seems like we've strung about three of them together right in a row. So I wanted to thank you for your part in that and also for your article that drew so much discussion this week. JB got in a fight for you over at Celtics Blogs forums. Just wanted you to know that he...
Yeah, you're right. If you want to go over and read those threads, it's under the Celtics Stuff Live promo for tonight's show. Actually, it was a pretty thoughtful poster that disagreed with some of my hyperbole, and then, you know, we began to run down your article
a
bit.
You said it. We didn't.
Yeah. So, anyway, though, it's always enthralling. I love listening to you. I call you Bob. But is it Dr. McChesney? I know you're a professor out there in the Midwest somewhere. Doctor.
Well, yeah, Bob or Elrod. I go by either one.
Well, I totally articulate, enthralling, well-informed, and always a pleasure. Thank you.
Likewise here, guys. Keep up the great work.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. And that was Elrod Enchilada from Real GM joining us for, geez, it really is. It's three great shows in a row. I think it's because we haven't been forced to watch the team lose, and everybody seems to have a little bit more enthusiasm. I don't know. Maybe I'm just making it up.
How many hands can you pat yourself on the back with at one time, Chuck?
I don't know. I was hoping that you guys would chime in, but the two of you are just kind of like falling asleep at the wheel. I mean, come on now.
My mother taught me to take my praise from other people. It's not quite as becoming when you have to praise yourself.
Well, I think I'm also praising our guest, JB, you know. But how self-deprecating do you have to be, too? I mean,
I don't know. This three shows in a row thing, it just kind of it just grabbed me a little
bit. We had three great guests in a row and some really good calls, and I wanted to just give a shout-out.
What does that say about the guy we
had
on 4 weeks ago? Come on. I don't mean
all right, well, yeah. Why don't you shout out your quotes? You pay to the ass.
Anyway, maybe never mind. So I went over to a couple of the blogs today because I was interested in what some of the fans' reaction was to Ian Thompson's piece about the Celtics not having done their homework, whether that they were vulnerable on trades, and that rival teams are fully aware that Boston has that weakness in the front office. And I gave you Lucky 17 from Celtics Blog, who found Paul Pressey listed in his scout. That was responded to by E.H. Monroe over on that board. He says, as for the Paul Pressey claim, he's an assistant coach, guys. He doubles as an advanced scout, but that's something different from what the writer's talking about. More and more teams keep scouts on hand whose sole job is to compile background on players throughout the league so that their GMs aren't caught off guard in trades. Because of his assistant's duties, I sincerely doubt Pressey has that sort of time. At the end of the day, as the proof is in the pudding, the Celtics seem to get caught off guard every time they trade for a vet. For example, they're surprised at how bad Dickow was. If Paul Pressey really is their pro personnel scout, then he needs to be replaced because he isn't getting the job done. And then there was a nice long post over at Real GM from Sully, and I'll paraphrase it a little bit, but what he's basically saying is that Danny is not interested in other NBA players except as Phil and just to get ready until his own young players. And he says, I know he talks about developing assets, but frankly, I think it is media speak. He believes that coaching and development are just as important as talent. I think if the right deal comes along, sure, he will listen. But he wants this team to be about players he has drafted and developed. And then we go down. There's a poster named Colinto. And he brings in a wild card here. He says, this reeks of reliance on the brain doctor. The article is specific to the point out that the C's don't have a pro personnel scout traveling the league and collecting behind-the-scenes information on veterans. It doesn't say advanced scouting or talent scouting. Rather, specifically, behind-the-scenes kind of sounds like a private investigator, like the ones you hear about in the NFL draft who dig up character issues on draftees. Again, Ainge may feel John Niednagel's brain typing is a more accurate predictor of character and behavior, but based on the results, maybe it's time to stop trailblazing and do some more traditional detective work. Then we go to Mr. Turgon. I don't buy that lack of personnel thing for 1 minute. Rafe at the time was subject to a battery of tests, like Wally was, if anything, the doctors should have foreseen any problems. Apparently they didn't, and if you need people out there to evaluate the health of potential Celtics players instead of trusting the doctors you hire to make the tests, then, well, maybe the doctors aren't that good to begin with. Hard to believe we're talking about Boston here. And then I'm going to finish with egregious blunder, who made a nice long list of all the players that were acquired here that had played in the NBA before they came to Boston in the Danny Ainge era. And I'll read down the list. Mike James, Jumaine Jones, Jerry Welch, Chris Mills, Rafe LaFrance, Ricky Davis, Chris Mim, Michael Stewart, Chucky Atkins, Dana Barris, Ernest Brown, Gary Payton, Tom Gugliotta, Antoine Walker, Brian Scalabrine, Wally Szczerbiak, Michael Olowokandi, Sebastian Telfair, and Theo Ratliff.
I gotta tell you, Jamie, for a smoker, you have an incredible amount of wind. That's amazing. You are to be commended. No, good research, though. I'm glad you checked into, you know, what everybody was kind of thinking, you know, around. I was surprised, you know, that really, you know, the Ryan Gomes comments didn't really take on a life of their own. Telfair didn't really, you know, I mean, people are talking about it, but I don't think it sparked the debate that I thought it would. But, and then, you know, this one seemingly, you know, an article from national media, I guess is the way I want to put it, that, you know, they, you kind of expect them not to, you know, not to necessarily have all the information. I just didn't expect Ian Thompson's article to create as much of a buzz as it did, but obviously this is the hottest topic around right now.
Yeah, I'm not sure it is. I think I dug it out of the trash, to tell you the truth. All these threads were dead about 3 days ago. You know, people were interested in it for about 24 hours. None of the local press picked it up. No, I think I revived it myself.
It's a tough job, but somebody has to do it.
Well, I thought it was important, and it was one of these things I didn't want to fall under the radar. I'd like to see you know, somebody pick it up from here. Let's keep it rolling. Let's get the team to comment on it. Is it possible, if it is true, that they should spend a little more dough on scouting? We've commented before about a lack of European scouting. And I think, you know, I want to go back for a second to something I missed in Sully's quote, which I think is important. I think it's also a sign that Ainge likely trusts his own player evaluations. He matches his amateur scouting report with game tape to make his evaluations. He says this has left him very vulnerable in his player health department. Hits me here is that Ainge wants to look at it with his own eyes. He just doesn't trust anyone, and maybe that's the reason. He wants to make these decisions himself, and maybe he's trying to do too much. I'd hate to think it was because the ownership won't pay a little dough. We would like to see, you know, a European presence. When we had Fabio on, you know, he said that the Celtics were one of the teams, you know, that were rarely in attendance there, and you know, we've seen how that has helped in Toronto, and now we're hearing Golden State is playing close to a European style offense with some very good Euro players. There was a great article today with some quotes by Jessica Vicious, who will be a free agent this year.
You mean Yasikevich?
Whatever his name is, and he was applauding Don Nelson for being, he said, about as much of a European-style coach as there is in the league, except maybe for D'Antoni.
Wow, excellent. Well, I think it's time to wrap up the show.
By the way, John. If anyone's curious, I am on the show. I haven't left. I wanted to just throw in a couple.
Oh, sorry, John. We just don't have time this week.
I know.
John, I'm sorry.
Maybe next week. I'll get to talk in the last half hour. No, I just wanted to say that I think I'm not going to comment on the quality of the show, by the way. But I wanted to say, I wanted to point some people to Jess Camerato's post, or I should say her article on Hoops World last week in the aftermath of the Telfair thing. She had kind of a personal take on the, you know, who Sebastian Telfair the man is, and you know, I think that while the headlines and the cover stories are
You know, certainly, you know, and what we saw on the court is he's one type of player. I think there's a human, there's an individual who is a part of that, and I think that while it's easy for us to say, you know, the guy sucks and all he is what his performance on the court is, there's a reality to it. There's a human element to it, and you know, I think while certainly it didn't work out for Sebastian in Boston, you know, I think certainly I wish him luck. I think generally he is a good kid. I just think he's a little mixed up. He's a little misguided, and it's certainly something I think is worthwhile. And I hope you guys get a chance to go over to Hoops World, check that out, and you know, I'm sure we'll have her on again very soon, and you know, for that matter, we're going to have a pretty active schedule coming up here in the next month. We're now just 3 weeks away from the lottery balls hitting coming out and knowing our fortunes. So we're going to have a pretty busy schedule coming up, and then obviously for the month after that until the draft. So keep your ears peeled. We'll have plenty of we'll have Eric Weiss on for sure. We'll have a lot of the draft guys. We're going to have agents. We're going to have everybody you can think of on the show. So make sure you tune in.
That's great, John. I'm glad that you brought up Jessica's article. You know, she's getting quite a name for herself. She was the only one really to jump out and talk about the 57 team being left on the sidelines during the Dog and Frisbee show last week. And then this week she came out with the first one to have a somewhat sympathetic article to tell fair, or at least, you know, showing the human side of the situation. And, you know, I guess Mike McCann mentioned Scott Souza, who came out with an article today, you know, a little bit more bringing out some of the contradictions and perhaps hypocrisy and how they dealt with Telfair. But, you know, Jessica is coming along, and I think, you know, dare I use the word journalist, you know, I think we got a good one coming up here.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, guys, we're going to wrap the show. Big thanks to Michael McCann from Sports Law Blog. Check out his website. And Elrod Enchilada from Real GM. Two very good guests yet again. I'm very excited about that. And, John, good work lining up our guests. And I'm enjoying having the two guests on the same show again.
Yeah, it was fortuitous timing for us. We had two great guests. We have two professors, two very intellectuals, you know, raising the bar of Celtic Stuff Live. So next week we can go back into the dungeon and you know, start talking about hair color and cheerleaders and things. But no, it was great to have both these guys on. They're very, very smart, very well reasoned in their thoughts, and we love, you know, I think that they spoke well of themselves, and you know, hopefully we can have some other guys around the team. I think generally the folks that cover the team are a little bit wary, a little bit worn down after watching a very bad basketball team, very tough year, and so some of the guys that we've had on, I think we're taking a little bit of a break for their sake and their mental well-being.
Right, it's more of a hiatus than a sabbatical, that's for sure.
Exactly. We're going to go back to those guys here in a little bit. But, you know, it's even for us, you know, the last couple weeks have been tough. Certainly, you know, after 82 games of a very, very tough season. So we're looking forward to brighter and better futures ahead.
That's right. And we'll be back here next week from 7 to 9 p.m. Take a look on the blog, CelticStuffLive.com, for all of you iTunes listeners to see who our guest will be. In the meantime, we are taking a call, or we are taking calls. You can leave a message on our voicemail for the show. If you have a question or comment, the toll-free number, 866-751-9649. And don't forget, you can also email us at contact@CelticStuffLive.com. We'll see you next week.
Thank you all for listening.
Unchain my heart.
Unchain my heart.
Baby, let me be.
Unchain my heart.
Unchain my heart. 'Cause you don't care about me. You got me sort of like a pillowcase, but you let my love go to waste. So unchain my heart, oh please, please set me free.